Hawkeye, Tokyo, Australia, Germany, Africa.
Here we go. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! And here we go. It is a minute past the hour on this, the 28th day of November, 2016. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live, and that's where you go if you want to jump into the chat room, which is, in its present version, alive for another month or so. Remember, the chat room goes away, because of Java here in a few months, so we'll be making a transition. But for the next month or so, thanks to Sparky, we still have the regular Horn chat room. So, much obliged. Thank you, Sparky. Thank you very kindly. And if you would like to join us in the chat room, and you are mightily welcome to do so, I heartily encourage you to run on over to HeadOnRadioNetwork.com and pick up... find that link. I'm sorry, I was clearing a bunch. For some reason or another, I think the cat did some keyboard walking. I had to get rid of that in the chat before I got into the chat room. At any rate, just go over to HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, click on chat room, pick yourself out a screen name and a password, and bang, you'll be right in the room where you will be merrily greeted by Hoghead, Jug of Punch, Labor Man, Steve from Georgia Stan, BT Blom, and longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator, Sparky, who is content to keep his space unfolded and remain Sparky for the evening. Mm-hmm. We're rolling. And sending. Of course, also, the stuff that we take care of at the top of the program, a note, this is a listener-supported radio program. We have $490. Thank you, Don, and thank you, Kurt. Thank you very kindly. We have $490 to go to finish out the month of November. I'm just going to set that there and say, you know, why don't we just do that now? Let's wipe out the month of November right now and hopefully get a leg up on December. $490, that's one at $490, two at $245, four at $122.50. Yeah, $61.25 for eight. Ten at 49 or 49 at 10. Any way you slice it, that's what it takes to knock things down and finish off November and beat the Swede. Mm-hmm. So I'm seeing here in the live, in the chat room from people listening live that, the stream's not getting out. I don't know why that is. We're sending and got good levels and all of that fun stuff. Huh. Really? We're going to do this tonight. Okay. Well, at least we'll have some sort of a recording later, perhaps. Here in a few minutes, I'm going to be joined by the one and only Ed Rabel. Emmy-winning journalist, longtime journalist with CBS and NBC. Ed has a wide variety of experience with Cuba. And as you know, Fidel Castro passed away on Friday, but and the real question becomes one of what now for Cuba? You know, just 90 miles off of our southern coast. Well, it may, you know, climate change being what it is, another 100 years or so, it may be 500 miles off the coast once South Florida is underwater. But anyway, I've got, I asked Ed to join us in conversation this evening, and he graciously agreed. Good evening, Ed Rabel. How are you?
I'm well. How are you, Bob?
You know, a good Saturday of college football. Mountaineers decided not to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, so, you know, I'm ahead of the game. But as far as how about your weekend?
It was great. But I think if we're going to talk about Cuba, I have some news for your audience, which I would like to transmit now.
And that's where we were going.
Yeah. Well, it seems that Trump has threatened today to end President Obama's push to forge diplomatic relations and relax sanctions against Cuba. In a tweet, Trump said that if Cuba is unwilling to make a better deal for the Cuban people, the Cuban-American people, and the U.S. as a whole, I will terminate deal, he said. Now, he didn't tell us exactly what kind of changes he would seek, but his comment hints that the president, that he has been critical of the shift toward greater engagement between Americans and Cubans, and it hints that he's considering reinstating the restrictions on commerce, trade, and financial transactions that Obama stripped away since he announced 2 years ago that he and President Castro, Raul Castro, had agreed to normalize the relations. So that's for those who are, you know, we're looking to go to Cuba and do it quite easily under the relaxation that Obama brought to bear. It may be that you better get to Cuba soon because all of that relaxation may go away and he may tighten things.
And to the extent that this was done as a matter of executive action, it can be undone just that fast, can't it, Ed?
That's right. Exactly right. These policy changes, as you point out, were done through executive order, and President Trump can reverse them. But, you know, I think that Mr. Obama's press secretary made a good point today after he heard about this. He said that Trump would have a hard time reversing this policy, because it's already yielded business deals that have bolstered American companies and benefited the people of both countries. So we'll see what happens.
Well, and I mean that was kind of part of the whole thing as it went forward anyway. It was a see how this all plays out.
Right.
I don't want to see us go backwards into stupidity. But Ed, the fact of the matter is, on November 8th, we started going backwards into stupidity with our feet on the accelerator.
That's for sure.
So, you know, oddly enough, when news of Castro's death hit the wires, the first thing I thought of is, you know, poor Cuba. There are people in that island who love and revere Fidel Castro. There's also a younger generation that, at least according to the mainstream reports that I read, you know, really didn't give him much thought at all because he hasn't been in their lives for 10 years or so.
Yeah, that's right. He stepped down. He got sick back around 2006, and he stepped down and turned the reins of power over to his brother, Raul, who became officially the new president in 2008. So here we are in 2016. That's, you know, a long time, and many of those kids, when Castro stepped down, many of those young people you're talking about were, you know, just infants or in their twos and threes. So clearly, Castro's reign, I mean Fidel Castro's reign, was all theoretical to them. And while they are the beneficiaries, many of them, of the policies that Castro put into place, including free health care and free education and housing and food, they are the beneficiaries of those things, but that, they don't directly, I think, relate that to Fidel Castro.
No, the younger generation wants what young people want, the latest gizmos and gadgets.
Sure.
They want technological freedom to post cat pictures on Facebook. I'm being a little bit of a smartass, but it's true.
And
one of the things that I was thinking about, Ed, was that now Cuba will be free to be capitalized, and they can go back into the darkness of illiteracy and postpartum death and the inadequate health care and the glorious misery of the Batista days. Is that likely to happen?
It could happen, but the Cubans and the Cubans under Castro, both Castros, learn to deal with this kind of policy a long time ago, and they dealt with it quite well. They sacrificed, as you cannot imagine. I recall when the Soviet Union collapsed, I was down there, and I remember Gorbachev going to Havana and having a come to Jesus meeting with Fidel, saying, look, the Soviet Union can no longer support you. We can't infuse $5 billion annually as we have been because we're collapsing and we can't afford it. And you, Fidel, are going to have to integrate your economy with that of the Western Hemisphere, and meaning you're going to have to start opening up and do some free enterprise and have entrepreneurs in your country. And Fidel, being the hardcore kind of guy he was, he rejected that, and they had a really tough time of it for a while, really tough. It was so bad that tens of thousands of Cubans rallied on the Malecón, the seaside drive there in Havana, and staged protests against the government, which was absolutely unheard of until that time, about 1989, 1990, just as the Soviets withdrew the aid. And ultimately, Fidel had to order hundreds of thousands of bicycles from China simply to give people a way to get around the island, because the fuel had from the old Soviet Union had been cut off, and they couldn't get the cars to run or the buses to run. So it was a really bad time, and I remember it vividly. But what I'm saying is, the Cuban people have known sacrifice, and it'll be tough because these young people have wanted more, and if they have to undergo the same thing that their parents had to undergo before, I don't know exactly what's going to happen.
Well, it's made doubly frustrating and doubly uncertain, if not trebly. Because of Trump, he's the most unstable leader or incoming leader of a world power in generations. And I had wondered, Ed, the stubborn nature of his hanging on to his business interests, I kind of imagined him trying to jump down there and get a Trump International Hotel somewhere down on the Malecón, or in old Havana, or one of his gaudy, gleaming, god awful glass hotel towers. It doesn't seem like that, though. Or is this leverage for that, do you think?
Well, you remember during the campaign, he was censored for, and I don't know whether he was fined or not, but for launching, he had people go to Cuba and in violation of the economic embargo against Cuba, searching for a way to put a hotel in down there with a casino. So he already has indicated that he would like to do that. I'm just wondering whether we might see more efforts in his negotiation with Raul Castro to do something like that. But I must say that the Cubans are in firm control of, right now, of how, who invests in their country and how they invest. And, you know, if Trump threatens and cajoles and so on, I'm not sure that the Cubans are going to, you know, be that easy and give in to this guy. Because when I was down there recently, I talked with the high-ranking officials in the Cuban government, and they were just as worried as you and I are about what this guy is up to, because he is so unstable, and because he's so unpredictable, and because the Cubans felt that with Obama and Raul Castro making peace, that and they were hoping, of course, that Hillary Clinton would be elected president. So all bets are off now.
And how, just for perspective's sake, Ed, how old is Raul?
Raul is in his 80s. I think he is in his late 80s. And right now, he and a lot of the other leaders in the Cuban government were in the Sierra Maestra with Fidel when he launched his revolution in Cuba back in the late 50s. As we all know, he triumphed in early 1959, January, actually on the eve of the new year. Batista left, fled to Cuba and turned turned things over to Fidel. So he's, but you know, these guys are really old, and the question is, how long are they going to live, and who's going to be the next leader? We don't know. There are indications that a vice president who's in his late 50s, he's a micromanager, he was anointed by Raul Castro, but you know, Cuban politics are pretty opaque, so it's hard to know exactly who might wind up as the next leader.
Well, under those circumstances, yeah, though, any way you slice it, the Cuban Revolution is going to go through a generational shift. Do we have any sense for what the attitudes of that next generation are?
Well, we know for sure. You know, Raul, unlike Fidel, loosened things up on the island. He did open things up so that Cubans could engage in private enterprise in certain areas. For example, they can open up private restaurants, they can open up private shoe shops, open up private auto repair operations. Raul understood that the Cuban government, the socialist government, couldn't do everything. You know, particularly the mundane average things that we all depend on every day of our lives. So many Cubans now, about 500,000 out of a total of 11 million, are engaged in private enterprise. And that is, it seems to me, from talking with young people down there, is the way in which they hope their country will now move. And Raul has permitted that on a small scale. But these young people hope and pray that that this will flourish, that it will be more robust. And so that's what they're looking to do, because, as you pointed out, you know, this is a new age with a new technology, and they know what's going on in the United States. They know it so well that many tens of thousands of them are fleeing Cuba all the time, trying to get to America. So if they're going to stop that kind of thing, they're going to have to open up their commerce and sort of go to a more mixed economy.
Does the United States still maintain its dry foot policy, Ed?
Yes. It's called the Cuban Adjustment Act, Bob. And the way it works is this. If you are able to arrive at a border station, you know, the Miami International Airport or the border at between Mexico and the United States, and you show you're a Cuban and you show the immigration officer your passport, and you simply state, I want to remain in the United States. I am seeking, political refugee status. You can, they immediately, you're allowed to come in, and there are all kinds of benefits, and after a year you can get a green card and a residency and so on. So there are big benefits to Cubans that other immigrants don't have, and it all falls under an act that was passed a long time ago during the old Soviet era. You know, when I first started going to Cuba in 1975, it was at the height of the Cold War. So to try to embarrass the Castro regime and also to stick a finger in the eye of the Soviets, the U.S. Congress passed a law allowing Cubans a far easier way to get into America, into the United States.
And so that, as you just alluded, that continues. People do continue to try to get to the United States. But back on the island itself, and, you know, I know you've been there a number of times recently, among other things, facilitating that lovely piece that Linda Ellerbe did on Cuban children. You know, the world has to deal with things like climate change.
Right.
And, because we've got two generations of isolation from the Cuban island, people don't think about the geography there, but it's mountainous in some parts. They are probably better able to weather some aspects of climate change than, say, South Florida is. Have you been around in Cuba to see, I mean, do you have any sense of what their thinking is in that regard? And what the interface would be between any attempt to deal with climate change and an influx of capitalism?
Good question. They are the Cuban leadership is very, very conscious, environmentally aware and very conscious of what's going on. In fact, not only are they aware of what's happening worldwide with regard to those who are supporting the environment, but they themselves are quite up to date on how they deal with their ecology and the environment in Cuba. But, you know, as long as we have this economic embargo, the United States had imposed an economic embargo more than 50 years ago, imposing sanctions on Cuba in the hope that so much pain would occur that the people would overthrow the, bring about regime change down there. Well, it didn't happen. It didn't work. In part, that's why Obama wanted to get rid of this antiquated Cold War era, hostility toward Cuba, and in order to try to bring about a normalization with regard to how we do everyday business, including issues about the environment. For example, if right now the Cubans and the Chinese are cooperating in developing oil fields just off the coast, north coast of Cuba, between the United States and Cuba, between Florida and Cuba. Now, if something were to go wrong, if there were a huge spill, and that's a real possibility, there would be no way for the United States and Cuba to cooperate in trying. U.S. couldn't come to their assistance because the economic embargo forbids that kind of interrelationship. So it's just crazy, you know. It's high time that we, not the, you know, in Trump world, try to put our feet on the necks of the Cubans. It's time that we cooperated with them because it's really in the interest of the United States and Cuba to do so.
Well, the relationship with China was something I wanted to touch on as well. Of course, in the wake of the Soviet collapse, the next thing that the Cubans did was to establish a vibrant relationship with Venezuela.
Correct.
But under the Maduro government, Venezuela is almost past being able to help itself now.
That's correct. That's exactly right. And, you know, the relationship between Cuba, traditionally, under Chavez, of course, was that the Cubans would supply literally thousands of healthcare workers and physicians to work in parts of Venezuela that never have had any kind of professional help from physicians, and the Cubans sent hundreds and hundreds of doctors to Venezuela. In exchange, it's not a direct exchange, but in exchange, why the Venezuelans, of course, supplied Cuba with the oil that the Soviet Union used to supply. So therefore, at much reduced rates. So that was terrific. But now, as you point out, Venezuela is virtually on in economic freefall, and they're not able to supply that oil. So once again, Cuba is feeling the pressure that has been applied by that they're feeling as a result of not being able to get the oil from Venezuela. It's unfortunate. The Cubans still send their doctors over there, but the oil is not flowing.
Well, and I ask in part because there's a whole lot of Cuba that is still very much an agrarian society.
Right.
Is the island able to feed itself?
They import much of their foodstuffs, and unfortunately, because as you point out, the island is very fertile, very rich soil, and they could be doing more in terms of growing the crops that they need, particularly, for the masses of the Cuban people, but also all of these small private restaurants are popping up to serve the tourist trade, which is really an important aspect of the economy of Cuba. And all of that, much of that food stuff that these private restaurants have to use in order to satisfy the tourists who are coming in from outside of Cuba, obviously, that has to be kind of special. If somebody's on vacation, they don't necessarily want to just eat rice and beans. They want something else. And so expats and others have to bring that food in from the outside for these private restaurants to have a go of it. But the Cubans really need to develop agriculture on a much larger scale than they have down there. But that goes to a question of whether there would be a violation of the socialist principles of Cuba. And Raul has said that despite this normalization that the Cuba underwent in 2014, that Cuba is not going to give up on its socialist principles. We'll see how that works when Trump takes power.
It's all, there are a million questions here. You mentioned the relationship with China. Or as Trump pronounces it, China. Jesus, it's
Alec Baldwin.
Ed, it's gonna be a tough 4 years just listening to that freak. And I'm sorry, I call him a freak. I mean, there's nothing there to respect. There are questions after questions within questions within questions.
Can the Chinese
bolster Cuba sufficiently to provide a bulwark against being bulldozed by us?
I don't think that is the way it will work, and the Chinese never were able to do the same kinds of things in Cuba that the Soviets did. And of course the Soviets did it because they wanted their spy base there. They had a huge listening post down there for years and years and years, and they also maintained troops in Cuba until we found out about it, and the Soviets had to withdraw the troops as well. China doesn't have that kind of relationship with Cuba, and I'm not sure that that China wants that kind of relationship.
Well, it doesn't serve their vested interests. I mean, to the extent that they're expanding in the Western Hemisphere, China has a much greater stake, say, in Brazil.
That's right. Correct.
Tell me, I noticed the photo that you sent me. When and how many times did you meet Fidel Castro?
I met him. I started seeing Fidel Castro in the mid '70s, and that, again, as I said, was the height of the Cold War. I have been going to Cuba four or five times a year since then, so we're looking at more than 150 times in Cuba, and so obviously I have seen the various iterations that have occurred, the changes in Cuba, how Cuba behaved at the height of the Cold War, when they basically were kept afloat by the Soviet Union. And then as the Soviets, that picture was taken at the same time Gorbachev was in Cuba talking to Fidel about how he was going to have to integrate his economy in the Western Hemisphere, and that was like 1989. And I've been going ever since, not only as a correspondent for CBS News and NBC News, but also guiding my students there. I'm an adjunct professor of broadcast journalism at Washington State University, and I take students there annually and have been doing that for several years now. So, I clearly have had the good fortune of being able to watch Cuba not from a theoretical point of view, but from actually hands-on and from one end of the island to the other. And I've had the good fortune of meeting not only top officials of the government, but also just regular folks, artists, musicians, regular farmers, office workers and others. So it's been quite an experience, and I feel quite gratified for having been able to do that.
It is an enviable experience, Ed. With Fidel's passing, let's take a moment, if you would care to, and sort of try to take a run at a balanced measure of the man's life.
Right.
He was middle class. He was he came from the so-called bourgeoisie of Cuba. Did he not?
His father was a Spanish soldier who was sent along with other Spanish forces to Cuba during the Spanish-American War to fight against the Cubans who were trying to oust the Spanish. And of course, after the Cubans were successful in doing that, Fidel's father, Angel, stayed on, became a street peddler in the streets of Santiago de Cuba, which is Cuba's second largest city, and it's in the eastern end of the island. Havana is moreover closer to Mexico, just 90 miles away from Key West. Santiago de Cuba is the second largest city, and it was there that his father just started out as a street peddler and then finally wound up owning lots and lots of acreage of sugarcane fields in the eastern end of the island, and became quite wealthy, and that's how he was able to send Fidel and Raul and Ramon, both Ramon and Fidel are dead now, but send them to Havana from the eastern end of the island to get a very good Jesuit education. So that's how Fidel began, and he got his early education there, as taught by the Jesuits, and then he went on to the University of Havana, where he got his law degree. And it was there that he was rebellious, and it's said that he once, to show how brave he was, he rode a bicycle into a brick wall to show all of his friends how stubborn and tough he was. And those guys used to carry pistols around with them all the time on campus. And so he, clearly it was had an extraordinary personality. Some called him an egomaniac, but he certainly was able to convince people to join him in his revolution. Things were so bad on the island, though, under Fulgencio Batista, that my imagination is that it wouldn't take much to encourage, because much of the island was in flame over how horribly Batista was treating the citizens of Cuba. So that was his early experience in Cuba.
And most people, I suspect, don't know that that Cuba had its own independence and desires and yearnings for freedom going way back. Read up the history of Jose Marti, and you understand that that was something that was always simmering in the background. The Spanish-American War. Theoretically, we were going to run the Spanish out, and then we turned around and proved to be arguably as bad as the Spanish in terms of being colonialist masters, yeah. Imperialist, whatever we want to use the word. But So Fidel got himself into some trouble with the government. Served some time, didn't he?
Well, here's what happened. In 1953, Fidel and about 100 of his fellow revolutionaries in the city of Santiago de Cuba attacked on a late Saturday night, early Sunday morning, the Batista barracks there, a big military installation. They attacked the barracks and in the hopes of being able to catch the soldiers off guard and to take over the Batista military barracks in Santiago, Cuba. And that was 1953. It was a horrible failure, a big mistake. Most of the revolutionaries were wiped out, slaughtered, or tortured to death if they survived. And Fidel, it's not a laughing matter. He and a few other revolutionaries got lost in the kind of winding streets of Santiago de Cuba, and they, realizing that the attack was failing, they ran off into the woods, and they were captured by Batista's forces. Some of those guys wanted to kill Fidel right there on the spot, but one of Batista's sergeants, urged the other soldiers to spare Fidel's life, and that's how he survived that one. He was captured, he was put on trial in Havana, and he carried out his own defense, and a record of how he defended himself was captured, and it appears now in a book called History Will Absolve Me, and it's the entire defense as Fidel laid it down in his trial. He was imprisoned the sentence was for 15 years, but Batista made a big mistake. He released Raul and Fidel and Che Guevara and sent them into exile in Mexico, where they were able to organize. Actually, it wasn't Che. Che met up with Fidel in Mexico. They were able to get arms and ammunition together, and they bought a boat called the Granma, which was a kind of yacht. So there were 88 revolutionaries, including Fidel and Raul, who got on board this yacht named the Granma. By the way, that's the name of the newspaper, which is the official organ of the Communist Party down there. But in any event, so they go on this yacht back to Cuba, and much as the Bay of Pigs disaster, the boat came of they never made it to shore, and they had to get on shore, and then many of them were captured by killed by the Batista forces, who intercepted them, and it was about 12 or 13 of them who got away, including Fidel and Raul, who went into the Sierra Maestra, and from there they conducted their revolution.
And along the way, by then, Che Guevara was part of it.
That's right. Che was on the boat. Raul was on the boat. Fidel, and so they were all teamed up to ultimately bring so much pressure to bear on the Batista forces that on New Year's Eve, 1958, Batista gave up the ghost and fled to the Dominican Republic, and Fidel marched into Havana 8 days later.
Were the Castro brothers committed Marxists at the time?
No, I don't think so. I think that Fidel Castro was the last of the, you know, great caudillos of Latin America, the strong man on a horse. And he was very much, I think, committed to himself and to the betterment of Cuba and Cuba's people. After the revolution, he was adored, and he did bring about socialist ideas and also programs on the island that benefited millions of people who had been, in terrible straits under Batista. So He did that, but I think that when he found, he wasn't even a member of the, you know, the, in Cuba there was a communist party, even before his revolution succeeded, and, but Castro never became a member of that communist party, and in many ways he distanced himself from the old communists, there in Cuba. So, but I think once, the United States tried to assassinate him, and once he, you know, time after time after time, and once he realized that the U.S. wasn't about to let him govern on the island freely and independently, I think he then was, I think he was forced to then turn to the Soviet Union and then and therefore Marxism-Leninism after he realized that it was either going to be the United States or the Soviet Union. That island could not really stand on its own at that time.
How did the United States diplomatically bungle in the Eisenhower administration the response to the Cuban Revolution as badly as it did?
Well, it was as you said, under the Eisenhower administration, they felt that like every other dictator in Latin America, they would be able to control him, and they wanted him to play ball, and he refused to do that. Unlike, you know, the far right military dictators in all those other countries down there, we forget about how the United States supported Latin American military dictators from Pinochet in Chile and Somoza in Nicaragua and Papa Doc and Baby Doc in Haiti and all of these really bad characters. As a matter of fact,
yeah, it seems like it. I mean, our Caribbean policy, our Latin American policy, for a very long time was if you're a nasty, brutal, murderous dictator with right wing tendencies, we love you.
Yeah, well, that's right, and we did because we were under a lot of at that time, as you point out, at the height of the Cold War, we were in a global struggle ideologically with the Soviet Union, and we weren't about to allow the Soviets to try to penetrate the Western Hemisphere or to project power into the Western Hemisphere, but they were successful in doing it through Cuba, and that clearly, I mean, with the introduction of intercontinental ballistic missiles, nuclear-tipped missiles in Cuba, that was the last straw. So everybody's familiar, I guess, with the Cuban Missile Crisis and what happened there. But that was the upshot of these tremendous pressures that they were bringing to bear. You know, in Castro's revolution resulted from Batista's torture and execution of thousands of Cuban citizens. Cuba was ripe for revolution, and Castro provided Cuba with the relief from what was basically a U.S.-backed strongman. And John F. Kennedy said about the Eisenhower administration supported Batista, he said, Fulgencio Batista murdered 20,000 Cubans in 7 years, and he turned democratic Cuba into a complete police state, destroying every individual liberty. Yet U.S. aid to that regime and the ineptness of our policies enabled Batista to invoke the name of the U.S. in support of his reign of terror. Administration spokesman publicly praised Batista, hailed him as a staunch ally, a good friend, at a time when Batista was murdering thousands, destroying the last vestiges of freedom, and stealing hundreds of millions of dollars from the Cuban people, and the United States failed to press for free elections. So that, you know, that's the legacy of U.S., not just in Cuba, but all over Latin America.
Sadly, yes. Of those, and you mentioned the murders perpetrated by Batista.
Right.
Who was he killing? I mean, was it just political enemies, political opponents?
Anybody who dared to oppose him, and any, you know, particularly these young people who were, they were coming up all over the island with anti-Batista operations, and not only in the press. They did have a free press at that time, but also in street demonstrations and whatever. And as I recall, you know, when I covered the Sandinista Revolution in Nicaragua, You didn't have to be anything but 16 years of age, and you were dragged out of your house and summarily executed. And that was the kind of thing that was going on in Cuba. You just, all you had to do was be a young person, and you were dead.
And so I delved into that, Ed, because I'd like to know, or you know, as we sort of note the life of the man, he was certainly an outsized presence, given Cuba's status. I mean, not a great nation, but he turned the world's focus to it. But along the way, the critics of the regime say that it was a brutal dictator who killed his own people, blah, 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 blah. And I don't mean to be dismissive of that, but the fact of the matter is it happens on a continuum, not much different from anything that Batista did. And yet you've got these cranky old Cuban exiles in South Florida who scream about what a monster Castro was. I guess it was okay with them that Batista was killing Cubans as long as he wasn't killing them. And it was the appropriation of private property that really sent it over the edge, wasn't it?
Well, I think that. But also all the other privileges that there was a core of, at that time, at the time of the revolution, there were about 6 million people on the island. Today, there are more than 11 million. But out of that 6 million, there were about 250,000 Batista cronies who had held the power. Ironically, Batista, who was of mixed color, mixed race, mestizo, these whites down there who fled in the first wave of Cubans who came over to the United States, who refused to believe that Castro was going would be in power very long. They refused to believe that the United States would permit that. And instead of staying on the island and fighting him, if that's what they believed in, they fled to the United States. But ironically, these whites would not permit Batista to enter their own yacht clubs and private golf clubs and so on, because he was a black man. You know, he had black blood in him. And so he built his own resort and wouldn't let them in. So it was ironic. But my point is that first wave of Cubans who came, and some of them still are alive today, and some of their offspring are still hardcore.
Well, I think of Ted Cruz and his nasty father.
Exactly. And Rubio, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, Rubio was not, I think he was born here in the United States, but...
well, his parents didn't even flee Castro.
No,
they fled, that's
correct,
yeah.
Earlier.
They fled the previous violence and dictatorship. But so when Castro consolidates power, the story we're told in the United States is that he clamped down on free speech and democracy, et cetera.
Right.
We seldom mention the fact that life got dramatically better for, in Mexico, their campesinos, you know, the peasant class. Their lives got markedly better, did it not?
It did indeed. And you have to remember that today, life expectancy in Cuba is much greater than it is in the United States. Infant mortality is much lower in Cuba than it is in many parts of the United States. The Cuban people physically are in pretty darn good shape because of the extraordinary health care that is free and universal there in Cuba, and because they learn. They have a very good educational system, so they learn how to take care of themselves. But at the same time, there was a leveling of society, and that is to say, today, most people, 80% of the people, work for the government, and they only earn about $18 a month. They struggle, and while they have been the beneficiaries of that revolution, after a while... of sacrificing, many of them, especially young people, as you pointed out, want more. And so I think that therein lies the question of, what next for Cuba.
But they are an educated people, as you point out.
Absolutely.
And so they're not necessarily going to be a pushover for just having the things that they value taken away from them.
Well, that's correct.
I mean, one hopes.
Yeah, one hopes that. But there is the problem there on the island that if you are graduated from university, you are very well skilled, you're highly educated and so on, there the opportunities are just not there. And so that's why you see many thousands of Cubans fleeing to the United States every year, and it's continuing at a rapid rate, particularly because Cubans have stepped up their immigration, stepped up their fleeing Cuba in out of fear that Trump may put an end to the special privilege that the Cubans have now, and that they will no longer be able to take advantage of this wet foot, dry foot policy. They were also fearful that if Hillary were elected, that she would put an end to it, because it wouldn't be, it isn't a fair system, obviously. If you are Cuban, you are instantly admitted into the United States, where other immigrants, you know, really are turned back and deported if they aren't here legally.
So, on balance, Ed, do you feel like, I mean, is there anything that we can say? Was Fidel Castro a net positive? Was he a net negative to the Cuban people?
Well, I think it's mixed, but based on what I've seen as far, one of the things that's problematic here is that if you compare Cuba to the United States, that's a mistake. I think that you really need to compare Cuba with other Caribbean islands. And while, if you do it that way, you realize that the Cuban people are in much better shape than people are on other Caribbean islands.
By far and away better off than, say, Jamaicans.
Oh,
or
right.
Even with an American perspective, consider the ongoing crisis in Puerto Rico.
Precisely. So there you have it. You know, I think that if you make those comparisons, then there's no doubt that the Cuban people are much better off. But I think that somehow, if unfortunately Mrs. Clinton was not elected, I think that we would have continued this normalization process. We probably would have ended the economic embargo. Now, as you know. Ending the economic embargo against Cuba, that's something that has to be done by the Congress of the United States. And so it's not up to the executive, it's not up to the president. What happened is Clinton, or the president at one time, the presidency, I should say, had the authority to end the economic embargo. But when the Cubans shot down some American aircraft, the Cessnas, over the Straits of Florida, Clinton, in a bow to Congress, turned over that authority to Congress. So now the question is, will a Republican Congress, be willing to end the sanctions, particularly if Trump says, nothing doing, I'm going to tighten things even more.
And that'll be so sad.
Yeah.
Ed, because... Well, I don't think we need that. But by the same token, I'm also very much a realist, and I expect precisely no good things to come out of this Congress. I don't think this Congress can do anything except saber rattle, warmonger, and try to beat up on people for being gay or people of color or poor. You know, I mean, I'm waiting for the Obamacare repeal to see, and adding into that mix any idea that they would get Cuba right. I think it's probably not a justified hope.
That's precisely right. It's just a return to the 1950s, if not before. I mean, it's just that same old trickle-down idea that never works, and the same kind of thing about being repressive when it comes to our own backyard, Latin America, you know, the idea that we can swagger and carry a big stick and just beat the hell out of people if they get out of line, and that's precisely how we're going to treat Cuba under a Trump administration.
And probably the rest of Latin America.
Yep.
Well, let me ask before we roll out, and I really appreciate the generosity of the time you've given us this evening, Ed. Where do you, and this is off topic, sort of, but where do you come down on the Trump administration? I'll tell you straight up, I advocate a resistance, and I'm not much interested in collaborating with them. But it seems like there is that element within our side of the political aisle that is, you know, at least warming up the kazoo to play kumbaya with them. Where are you on it?
I am really so depressed, is the word, about what has happened. I am so concerned about the fate of America under a Trump administration. I'm so worried about how divided our country is and how much more divided it will become, it seems to me, as we move on. I think that the other thing that bothers me is that I've had the good fortune and opportunity to travel all over the world and meet with leaders throughout our recent history, and I have never, ever seen anything to compare with how utterly reprehensible Trump is and how he is seen by so many world leaders as being just that. In many cases, it would be a joke if it weren't so sad and pathetic, what is happening to our country as a result of Trump, or what will happen to our country as a result of Trump. And I, you know, one of the problems that we all face is how helpless we feel in the face of this, and how unfortunately, the rule by, being all these folks who voted for him in many cases were so resentful. They were so of a mind that we elitists were making fun of them, mocking them. They were so unsure of themselves as a result of their failure to keep up. And as a result of that, we are even far more divided. And so I don't know. My concern is that there may be bloodshed as a result of what has happened, particularly if there is, if these folks start clashing. And
do you think based on evidence that we've seen thus far, do you think that we have a greater white supremacy, Klan, neo-Nazi problem than what we knew?
Well, what we had is that Trump has given license to all of those people who we didn't know really were out there. And as a result of that, he's given them permission to come out of the woodwork and remain quiet, but to vocalize and in many cases physically act out their anger and their opposition to people who are a little bit more educated and more enlightened. And so consequently, I really fear for that. Here's the thing about it, Bob, and that is resentment will trump the truth every time. And no matter how many lies have been told, as I've said, resentment, and these people are terribly resentful, resentment, gives license to and a free ride to bigotry and hatred. And no matter how many lies that have been told, and how disappointed these people are going to be who expect Trump to give them jobs and give them a better life and so on, and they're going to be terribly disappointed because that's not going to happen. Despite that, they'll never turn back on him. They will just be as resentful as ever, and he can play to their resentments and continue to, I think, prevail. And that's really the sad part of it.
I admit that this event that took place, this crime that took place in Columbus, Ohio today, has me nervous.
Yeah.
Just a couple more of those, or maybe something bigger, and this country will be prepared to hand over every last vestige of freedom, and put it into that man's tiny little hands.
I'm afraid so.
And so, you know, I have declared that this space, this broadcast space, is a part of the resistance, and I consider it that. I mean, I consider that we are entering into perhaps a new era of we've had fascist tendencies displayed in American government before, but we may be headed toward the real thing.
I hope not, but
I hope not
agree.
Too. But I'm afraid that we are. So I think we have to be prepared to resist. And you've got an outlet for your thoughts anytime you want to talk to a dedicated progressive community. We're here for you.
I really thank you for that, and I really appreciate your letting me be on tonight.
My pleasure, Ed. Take care.
All right. Adios.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Ed Rabel, Emmy Award-winning journalist with NBC and CBS, longtime expert on Cuba. I felt like he was just sort of the go-to guy to talk about what happened and what happens now that Fidel Castro is gone. Sorry, just doing a couple of things. I've got another conversation lined up for us. A reminder, at 2 minutes past the hour, we're trying to finish off the month of November fundraising-wise, and that means raising $490. It would be great if we could just go ahead and get that out of the way. So far, an hour into the program, we're at zero. Not even when you consider the $200 we try to raise every evening. So if we could jump on that, it would be great. The link is over at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute. And just help out because, you know, if we're going to be the resistance has to be able to be on the air. Parson Brown is a dear friend of mine, and we've been friends for a very long time. And Parson spent a lot of time in Appalachia documenting the struggle against mountaintop removal and then documenting the damages done to Appalachia. He is the founder of the Topless America Project. He's also a journalist. And recently, in his journalism capacity, he was present over the weekend before this past in Washington, D.C., when the neo-Nazis got together for their little rally. You know, the one, we played the audio, where they were saying, "Hail Trump, hail our country," given the stiffy salute, that kind of thing. And I thought it might be good to have a conversation with Parson about what he saw there and what all went on. Parson Brown, welcome to the program.
Bob, thank you so much for having me on, and I apologize. I, being on the road, came back to my desk and plugging all my, like, ins and outs together, wasn't even able to really get my technological abilities together until just now. Thank you for bearing with me.
Oh, it times out perfectly. So, like I said, introducing you, we've known each other for quite a while now.
You're
a committed activist against mountaintop removal, but you also have a real life. That may not be the right way to say it, but it's just that, you know, being an activist against mountaintop removal will not keep the lupine pest away from the porch. And so you got to go out and you got to work, and you're doing some journalism-y stuff. And you did happen to be at the NPI, the National Policy Institute, is that what they call themselves?
Yeah, the National Policy Institute. And like what I, you know, I always do my best to stand for environmental and social justice. And sometimes I get in on shows that I can't necessarily talk about until they come out. But this was something that was just so, like, monumental. Like, it was on the schedule for the day, and then we walked into something that I had never encountered before, and that was this conference of a group that had just been empowered in a way that, like, you would never imagine since Trump's election.
And, I mean, so were you there for the whole thing?
Well, I was there for about like 90% of it. We actually got called by our producers to make sure that we hadn't been the ones that leaked that video. That it wasn't us. Like, but that wasn't the first time that the motions had been made. That was not the first time that similar statements had been shouted out by any means. Like, that was the theme of the day, was a very national, not just nationalist, but racist rhetoric.
I'm kind of done with this concept, this phrase, this concept of white nationalist. It's white supremacy, it's neo-Nazism.
Well, that's something that even, like, I actually fire-watched our gear a little bit for their press conference, and they had press from all over the world asking them questions. And the few questions that they answered with such jest and with such a mocking, like, mentality. They were almost just, like, gathering everybody back from their conference after lunch to now sit around and make fun of the media. It was like, that was truly like the mentality that you felt.
Did you hear the word Lügenpresse at all?
I didn't hear it specifically like it was documented on the stage, but there was no hush hush about, you know, like that sort of banter or in the facility at all. You know, there was, you know, just joking around like you were in like a Nazi locker room, I guess. And like, as a journalist, you're just kind of like, what is, you know, like, you just find yourself in such a strange atmosphere. You're trying to maintain professionally your, you know, like, the best foot forward, but also just like really trying to understand what's happening.
Oh, I would have been gobsmacked by what you saw. So they've tried Parson to sort of play away from what they seem rather obvious to me they are, by saying, well, you know, it's kind of joking, it's kind of mocking. It's tongue-in-cheek. Did you get the idea that they were tongue-in-cheek?
Yeah, and that's where the real serious part of the skits is, that the tongue-in-cheek defense is something that I started out just as an observer being like, oh, they're just deflecting. But during the day, recognized how organized they were, and the fact that their real, like, oral and for their messaging, like, the way that they're playing the media is just by mocking them, basically doing a, you know, like, bounces off me and sticks to you sort of thing. It's like basically eighth grade politics if you watch the way that they deflect the media. And that's something that was continued throughout the entire day.
Well, we all saw that clip where they talked about once you've seen somebody giving stiff arm salutes in the United States, it's almost like you forget what else was said. But
and that was
they
that
ha- but they've got, they they're really really
right after, that was after their cocktail hour, which they advertised for the entire day, but there were certainly people doing the same thing periodically throughout the day. Our crew left before their cocktail hour.
What are their grievances?
Well, it's hard to say, and it depends on who you ask. Just by, like, working there in the background, like, there were lots of folks at, like, there was people that seemed like they were really looking to fit in somewhere, and we talked a lot about almost trying to impress you, like, you know, like, as they would approach me, you know, like, this is something that you want to be a part of. A group of people that look good and feel good. There was a lot of emphasis on like physical fitness and the way that people look. There was a lot of like very strict, parts in their hair and, you know, like, you know, groomed in a certain way that was reminiscent of, you know, what we kind of think of as like a Nazi or neo-Nazi, but very much like a culture of like brotherhood and fitness and superiorness. And then there was maybe 4% women there. There was a handful of women there, who I didn't get a chance to really interact with many of them, but that was like the general outlay of the culture there. And everyone was from all over the nation who had, I believe, that paid to travel there. Sort of like some of the conventions, Bob, that you and I have like gone to, for example, like to get people together to stop mountaintop removal, except that this is just a group of people that have an agenda to make sure that we
make
America a white race.
I mean, and that's
they,
I mean
what it, they call a pro-European agenda. It was the strangest thing I've ever been part of.
I mean, and that's where you get into the trouble into trouble, isn't it, Parson? Because you say it's an agenda to and to what? I mean. Is it a ship black people back to Africa movement? I mean, is it that stupid?
I think they pretty much were comfortable being like, they could go back was like probably the most like, well, like that was their like big answer. Like anybody that's here, that's not supposed to be could go back.
How can you go back to somewhere you've never been? Are these people stupid?
Well, no, actually, I, according to everyone, and like, keep in mind, like, I was just a crew member, just minding my business and, trying to support the folks that I was working for. But the folks that I did run into, there was a gentleman and his son, you know, very well dressed, very, polite folks that came up to me. And he asked me, so are you looking forward to the goat slaughter? And I was like, excuse me? And he's like, yeah, most people, you know, he was trying to make a joke, like, think that we're just a bunch of, you know, like, cross-burning, like, terrible. I was like, okay. And he said, but you realize we're just a bunch of intellectuals. And I was like, yes, sir. You're having a very civil conversation together.
Intellectuals. Intellectual Nazis. Well, I mean, I get, yeah, the Nazis fancied themselves intellectuals too, didn't they?
Well, yeah. Well, and they, yep.
Because they had scientific answers and they had theories of racial purity. I mean, that's what we're talking about here, isn't it?
That's what we need to be talking about, because I stumbled upon that just on a day where I thought we were covering something a little weird, but that was something that shook me.
It should. I mean, because
these guys are very organized.
And the thing is, they've already designated and determined who their Untermenschen are. And consequently, once you've identified and tagged the Untermenschen, you can start killing them, can't you? I mean, did you get any overtones of violence from these people?
Most of who I talked to were very polite and perhaps cautious of being polite. We were, by the way, like, you know, part of the media, and they were aware of media's presence. But and that was almost part of what made it scarier, was that you're hearing the rhetoric from the speeches and knowing that, like, you're sort of safe hearing people talk about such hatred. Most ironic thing was, you know, like, we're in Washington, D.C., and 90% of the security detail are African Americans, people of color, and wonderful people that, like, we got to know, like, throughout the day, but are doing their job to keep them safe, and security was very tight. There were protests outside the building that, you know, had to prevent people from coming inside to disrupt their conference because they had the right to be there.
And they are convinced that Trump is their road to their brilliant future. I mean, they see him as an ally, right?
They see him as an ally. They were very particular about who is alt-right. They don't see Trump as alt-right. They don't see Bannon as alt-right necessarily. But they do recognize that they are convenient avenues for them to pursue their agenda.
So did you, was there, was there,
quickly, and they are organized enough to act quickly.
So did you hear any chance of build the wall or that sort of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I was, there was a press conference, and one of the reporters, I forget the word for word what the question was, but it was something basically like, what do you think the first thing that the president-elect should do once he gets in office? And it was like a moment of pause, and then it was an entire room chanting, build the wall. And then they laughed about it.
Yeah, but they weren't chanting ironically, were they?
No, they were serious. And Mr. Spencer made it very clear. He's like, that's where they were at with it.
So, I mean, what happens if you confront them with facts like, oh, that, you know, this is going to cost billions upon billions of dollars? Does that matter to them? Were they pressed for anything in the way of details?
Right. No, like, I know where you're coming from, but, like, who's to say? Like, I don't understand.
I mean, they want all the undocumented immigrants rounded up. Hell, they want the regular immigrants rounded up, apparently. Do they have any notion of the logistical nightmare that they're talking about? I mean, that's the part of them that sort of strikes me as intellectual fools.
As I said, like, I can't disclose too much, but I know that as our, like, the company that I was working for did try to, like, approach a lot of people, but were more often than not dismissed. Like, and so it was a lot of dudes that wanted to raise their fists in the air and scream a lot of hoot and holler and get their picture taken with Tila Tequila, but wouldn't sign a release to actually, like, speak their, you know, state their case in front of, you know, the camera. So...
So cowards into the bargain.
So it's hard to... So it was like being at the strangest, kind of scariest carnival ever.
Now, you said they tried to recruit you?
Oh, well, there was a strange, at a certain point, our, not really recruit me, or maybe, I really don't know, but, like, you know, I was working with this group, and I was sent over to basically take my, like, equipment off, go up front, and buy, I was trying to see if they had any Make America Great hats, you know.
Yeah, those wonderful, those.
Or they'd already. We were planning to do something creative with it, but, like, it wasn't really for nostalgia. But I ended up buying a t-shirt that was, like, a Trump's face in a hashtag alt-right t-shirt that was for the production. It's, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So they sent me on this mission, and I got into this conversation with these folks that were just regular, like, kids, like, that could be, like, my little cousin or, like, your neighbor, and it's just like, dude, you're so much like me, like, you, like, we like the same stuff, you're, like, you seem, like, smart, you seem, like, a confident, like, the one guy, like, did soccer, and the other guy, like, was, like, a law, you know, like, studying law, and they were good at what they did, and it's, like, just, why would you focus your energy on such a negative thing to the point where now you're organizers of this? So, after that, I mean, that's what I took from it, but then after that, I think that they gave word to some of their other higher-ups, and then people kept coming and asking me if I wanted to, like, talk more about the, like, about the conference.
Oh, for pity's sakes. Did you get the, I mean, that had to just kind of creep you out a little bit. Do these people consider themselves patriots, patriotic?
It was like Stepford Wives, like, just, like, I, at a certain point, just had to sort of, like, do my job and keep, like, turning in a different direction.
Ugh. So, are you inclined, Parson, to, did this make you want to keep a closer eye on them, follow this so-called, even alt-right is euphemistic. I mean, these white supremacists, I mean, if it was in your power, how do we deal with them?
They call themselves racists, and we have to also call them racists, and we can't allow them to hide behind the term alt-right. And we need to keep an eye on what they're doing, but also we need to try to understand what it is that is radicalizing that anger in this subgroup of our communities. Because you think about and talk about all the time young people being radicalized into radical Islam and all sorts of other things, but it is very important to not lose track of some of these young men that have been obviously radicalized into this hateful movement as well, and they're gaining speed, and we need to stop that. We need to nip it in the bud, or stop it once and for all, however you look at it.
And that becomes the real inquiry. How do you do that? I think
we just need to be vocal about it.
Well, yeah,
for now.
Right, and I think another part of it is condemning it, making sure and not letting them get away with rebranding themselves as something other than what they are: Klansmen, neo-Nazis, white supremacists. White, like I said early on, white nationalist holds no meaning for me. Because white folks have been running this country for, a few hundred years now. So it's not like they need a separate nation. That's like the idea of white separatists is equally stupid. They're all going to move to Idaho?
This particular conference even had speakers from across the pond. Their pro-European approach implies that no land anywhere should be run by anybody but the white people. They were serious. This was a pretty serious conference. I never thought that I would witness such a foul group of people.
Well, that kind of puts a bow on it. Foul people. And I agree with you. Let me shift gears with you a minute before we run away, or Parson.
Sure.
What are you in your not day job? Have you been working on any MTR stuff lately?
We are working as always to spread awareness of mountain top removal coal mining and fracking throughout Appalachia and environmental injustice. Throughout Appalachia and across the country, Top of America Productions and Friends for Environmental Justice are working to build connections and try to strengthen communities and get people together so that we can, especially in this time after the election, to really regroup everybody. And we just want to be as available as possible to anybody.
Well, it's going to be these 4 years. Hopefully, it's only 4 years. Are going to be interesting because there were promises made about bringing coal back, and of course, you and I know what that means. More mountains blowing up, more people being poisoned, more water being ruined, more air becoming toxic. I think there needs to be a large scale conversation of, once again, how do we resist and how do we go forward?
Absolutely. Well, you know that I stand with you, and I think that we'll probably need to together bring that voice to Washington and throughout our Appalachian communities and organizations. But we certainly need to come to the table and regroup and understand what we're up against right now. We're up against a bush or worse, or whatever. We don't know what to expect with a Trump administration. But I think that if we stick together with all the organizations and all the coalitions that we've worked so hard to maintain communication with, we can take it from there. And we need everybody on board.
All hands on deck, without a doubt. Parson Brown,
exactly.
Thank you very kindly for joining in. Best of luck going forward in the work that you do. I know for a while you were working around here, weren't you?
A couple of years back? I was just there a few months ago.
Is that gig still going?
No, my gigs come and go, but my mission never ends.
Right, because it had something to do with, is it okay to say that it had something to do with West Virginia and, ginseng back then?
Yeah, that I'm cleared to talk about that one.
So you worked on, what was the name of the program?
That was the Appalachian Outlaws.
Yeah, because I know the Ginseng Whisperer. What's his name? Rufus? That's what I call
it. Rufus from West Virginia, from Somersville.
Yeah, I know him. We've had
of course.
We've had deep religious conversations down at the Rippy Mart. Very interesting.
Well, I hope that that I'll work with the Appalachian Outlaws show can help people respect the tradition of ginsenging and protect the population of ginseng so that we don't destroy it.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting when you think that, the guys who go out and do the ginseng work, they know when it's legal and they know when it's not, and they know how to go about doing it. On the other hand, you blow up an entire mountain worth of ginseng, and that's economic progress.
Yeah, I tried to bring that up in the show, but I was just a coordinator.
Right, right. Well, Parson, good hearing from you, and please stay in touch, and hopefully we'll run across each other at some point.
Yeah, it's been a long time. We need a night of rip round crazy on the DC streets again.
That would be fine and dandy by me, Parson. You take care now, and give my best to everybody.
Thank you.
All right, bye now. Old friend and witness to American Nazism, Parson Brown. I really appreciate Parson reaching out to me to talk about it. I don't know what I would have done had I been in that room. I guess, what, you just, well, you're there journalistically, so you got to maintain your journalistic dignity. But how do you, oh my God. Hey, look, a Nazi. All right. We are about halfway through this Monday edition of The Horn, the 28th of November, 2016. It's 28 minutes before the hour, before the third hour of the program. As I mentioned at the beginning of the program, I was hoping we might be able to just knock out fundraising for the month of November by raising $490. And we are thus far at zero. So it would be nice not to be at zero. The PayPal link is over at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute. If you prefer the United States mail, you can send checks and money orders to The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. Make them payable to The Horn, not Bob Kincaid. I never see them. That's what Boss Man Wayne takes care of. Note coming in from James, subject line alt-right. Once upon a time, the term Nazi was new, and the efficiency, the energy, and the cool uniforms grabbed the world's attention. But they couldn't hide their true nature. Rather than argue over the rebranding, let them have their name. It won't take long for alt-right to become synonymous with evil. Valid point. But I don't like pretending things aren't what they are. And probably more than alt-right, white nationalist is the one that grates on me. It's just white supremacy repackaged. But they don't like to be associated with that because of the negative connotations. You know, the same thing with the word Nazi. You know, they don't want to know, oh, we're white nationalists. We're not Nazis. You know, we don't have spiffy uniforms. Right. So this here being More and Monday, because it is, going to be a lot of More and Mondays in the next 4 years. I think it is incumbent upon us that we take note of, they're going to be doing a lot of this for the next 4 years, I have a feeling, too. Take note of some outbreaks of economic anxiety. Yep. It's all over the place. It's here, it's there, it's everywhere. It's in the air, it's on the ground, it's on the sea. I haven't seen any sea, but here's some economic anxiety, if I can, once again, get it to play. I had a had a note from our buddy Scott in Sweden saying, "Why, you know, why don't you just cue this stuff all up in on the front end?" I do, and it doesn't stay cued, and that sucks.
How many people, man?
Now, hold on here. This is some economic anxiety breaking out aboard a Delta flight, Delta Airlines, last week. Mm-hmm. Yeah, in the air. No kidding.
How many people, man? Oh, really? Ain't nobody gonna say no shit on this plane?
We can't hear you.
You can't hear me? Donald Trump, baby. That's right, this man knows what's up. We got some Hillary bitches on here. Come on, baby. Trump. That's what I thought. That's what I'm talking about. Hey, baby. Donald Trump. It's your presence. Every goddamn one of you. If you don't like it, too bad.
Hear that economic anxiety? Yeah, charming, aren't they? I mean, your heart just bleeds for them. Well, at least Delta Airlines, of whom I am not a big fan, anti-union and such as they are. An internal memo went out from the CEO of Delta. Let's see here. To Delta colleagues worldwide from Ed Bastian, subject disruptive passenger on DL-248. Thank you for the amazing job you did running our operation and taking care of our customers during the busy Thanksgiving holiday. At Delta, we strive to deliver a safe and reliable product. What is the product at Delta? Not falling out of the air? Is that it? Product. I mean, it's a plane ride, for God's sakes. But you know what I mean. At Delta, we strive to deliver a safe and reliable product while providing a customer experience that is second to none. Well, you know, you want a customer experience that's second to none there, Ed, if I can call you that, Ed. I don't know. He may be so cool that he spells that with a hyphen. But, no, you want that superior customer experience. How about putting a little goddamn leg room between the seats? I mean, anybody taller than a freaking leprechaun is in misery, whether it be 15 minutes or God knows. I can't imagine, like, flying Delta from L.A. to, say, Sydney in 26 hours or Atlanta to Johannesburg, 26 hours. My knees would be locked permanently in place. Yeah. Thank you. Wait a minute. Cowbell for Hoghead. Noting the Carlin reference, yeah. He's so cool, he spells his name with a hyphen. Ed, E-D, Ed. Right. And that's exactly what that is. That's a George Carlin reference. Good job, Hoghead. Let's see. You come to work every day prepared to serve our customers and to take care of each other while also dealing with the unexpected. As you may have heard by now, last week a video began circulating around the internet showing a disruptive passenger on board a Delta flight. Disruptive passenger? Why, that there was a proud Merkin. Yeah. A Trump Merkin. He's proud. This individual displayed behavior that was loud, rude, and disrespectful to his fellow customers. After questioning the customer, our team members made the best decision they could given the information they had, and allowed him to remain on the flight. Ah, an excuse. I don't know. Was it in the air already? Nothing. Eesh. Given the situation, they let him stay on the flight. However, if our colleagues had witnessed firsthand what was shown in the video, there is no question they would have removed him from the aircraft. He will never again be allowed on a Delta plane.
What about his freedom of speech?
Yeah, he'll probably have his own program over on Fox soon. Cletus the Yeller, some such. Right. Yeah, I know. Good question, Asa. Where were those fucking air marshals? Not on that plane! Part of being a reliable travel partner and a servant leader... Oh, that sounds very evangelical. ...is acknowledging our mistakes so we can learn from them and respond more effectively in the future. Delta has apologized to the customers on board the flight. We are also refunding those customers the cost of their tickets. I also want to make sure all of you know we have your backs. The heightened tension in our society means that now more than ever, we must require civility on our planes and in our facilities. We must stay true to Delta's core values and treat one another with dignity and respect. We also must remain committed more than ever to the safety of our customers and our crew members. We will not tolerate anything less. Again, thank you for all you do. Signed, Ed. Rather a roundabout way of saying, yeah, we did. We let him stay on the plane. Mm-hmm. Well, it's just economic anxiety. That's all. Economic anxiety also broke out in New York. In upstate. A newspaper story in the Democrat and Chronicle publication. A contract paraprofessional, everybody gets a title now, don't they? A contract paraprofessional working at the Children's School of Rochester, School 15, in the Rochester City School District, was fired Monday morning after making a racist Facebook post, according to Principal Jay Piper. Justin Murphy is the reporter on this story. The woman, Cassandra Sutton, was working as a substitute pre-kindergarten paraprofessional. Screenshots of her Facebook account show a recent posting in which she brags of catching a black person in the middle of a crime using the N-word and other obscenities. Now, just for journalistic clarity, the black person she caught in the middle of a crime was not using the N-word and other obscenities. Cassandra Sutton, the substitute pre-kindergarten care paraprofessional, used that term. Mm-hmm. And she used it really, really nastily, I might add. I would go so far as to say, you know, disgustingly. But, and there's a happy end. I mean, I guess these are both happy endings to the economic anxiety. Because she got canned. This is only going to make them angrier, though. Like the bank official who got canned down in Alabama last week or the week before. Here's what she posted. Decent African-American male armed and hiding behind the shed in my neighbor's backyard. Allegedly, they were WERE, in hot pursuit as he had been on foot, running yard to yard, ! I wonder why I don't ever see white males committing crimes on my street. I caught Perrin a few times. Some hood rat, N-word, breaking into my neighbor's car, hashtag sorry, not sorry, hashtag no, this isn't about you, hashtag if you're offended, such a bag of dicks, I think she meant suck, pre-kindergarten substitute paraprofessional, hashtag stop raising hood rats, hashtag black people are fine, N-word aren't big difference. So she got canned. And now she, too, will be a martyr to economic uncertainty, economic anxiety. Yes. And then economic anxiety also broke out in the Chicago area at an arts and crafts store. This was at Michael's. And they might be as right-wingy. I can't remember. Michael's might be as right-wingy as Hobby Lobby, but I can't recall offhand. Her economic anxiety broke out over a dollar. She was asked to purchase a reusable bag at Michael's. And that engendered this.
Let it use on your face. And I voted for Trump, so there. But you want to kick me out because of that? And look who won. And look who won. And look who won.
Okay, this lady is actually screaming that she's been discriminated against.
Her economic anxiety, that was just a taste. Her economic anxiety went on for about 30 minutes as she screamed, I voted for Trump. I voted for Trump. We won. So there. And claimed it was an act of discrimination to ask her to buy for a dollar a reusable shopping bag. Let's see. She went off on a 2-year-old kid and accused the 2-year-old of being a thief. Screams at employees, "You're a liar! I don't care because I'm a consumer. I'm a customer." Yells, you heard of her. I was just discriminated against by two black women, and you being a white woman, you're literally thinking that's okay? You're standing there with your baby thinking that's okay? I don't know what standing there with the baby has to do with it, but, well, okay. Ouch. So much economic anxiety. Going to be a long, long 4 years. But there's economic anxiety, and of course there's also gender anxiety. You know, don't you, that CoverGirl, the cosmetics company, has named its first male CoverGirl. James Charles And apparently, to be a makeup wearing guy, and I mean, involves using eyebrow pencils to give yourself great big Groucho Marx eyebrows. Yeah, okay. I mean, you know, there's like a he's got a some lip gloss or lipstick on, and I don't know if this is those are real freckles or if that's stippling. And maybe some mascara and a little neutral tone eyeshadow and great big Groucho Marx eyebrows. And apparently stubble is in. Well, naming James Charles the first male ambassador for CoverGirl. The corporation said, all our cover girls are role models and boundary breakers, fearlessly expressing themselves, standing up for what they believe, and redefining what it means to be beautiful. James Charles is no exception. Enter the homeschool conservative, Sarah. Who is conniptionated over James Charles, male ambassador for CoverGirl.
Mommy, why doesn't Daddy wear makeup? 6-year-old Mark reportedly asked his mom, Sarah. Both of us were caught off guard. We didn't know how to answer. I don't know why, but the most logical thing we could think of at that moment was to say, no, that's a girl.
And so Mommy responded by saying,
Daddy doesn't wear makeup because makeup is for girls.
But the kid pressed on, because kids will do that.
Well, why is that boy wearing makeup?
At which point, the moral quandary erupted.
Do I lie to my son? Or do I tell my 6-year-old my full opinion? I thought about lying and saying that's how his eyes really look. Or do I tell the truth and have a deeper discussion with him? Maybe that's the way his mommy and daddy chose to raise him. But that's not the way we are choosing to raise you. Does a parent end it there? Or continue to say, that is sinful and wrong. He shouldn't be doing that. And his parents are wrong. We can't take our eyes off our son for a single second. Thank God we homeschool. Thank God he'll learn, our little boy will learn about what happened when the Germans bombed the Alamo and Lewis and Clark dropped the atomic bomb on Japan. Thank God we homeschool. Our world is headed in a direction where my 6-year-old son is having to grow up so much faster than I want him to.
I mean, really, if you get right down to it, makeup for women is a cultural thing, not a gender thing. It's what the culture says. But any of us who happen to be around for, say, oh, I don't know, the 1980s, I mean, anybody, really, the Human League? Don't you want me, baby? You were working as a waitress in a... That dude had on more makeup than the But it wasn't just for the video. I mean, I remember when guys in eye makeup was a thing, and not just Boy George. Yeah. And maybe that's where we're headed. I don't know. I don't think I'm going to look good in great big bushy. I got Thufir Hawat eyebrows anyway. I'm not going to look good in great big bushy Groucho Marx eyebrows. I'm just not. But, you know, there you go. Thank you, Ron. Ron in the far frozen north. Keep calm. Keep clam, Bob. The 4 years will fly by. Yes. That's a new slogan here at the Horn, by the way. Keep clam and shuck off. Yeah, exactly. Gerald pointing out, I can see now that with these Trump deplorables empowered, I'm going to have to dig out the ultimate insult that I never use. Looks like it's going to get a workout over the next 4 years. That dumb. Yep, I know that word. Speaking of the woman having the hissy and I don't know. Which one are you talking about? Are you talking about the woman having the hissy in Chicago or the woman having the hissy in Rochester? Or, yeah. By the way, and I'm going right to the phones here just in a second. Economic anxiety broke out in, of all places, Sydney, Australia. The American disease always spreads to Australia. And it broke out at a... McDonald's in Sydney, according to the Daily Mail. A gay couple, Sam and Andrew, were attacked by a guy while he was waiting in line for, you know, a Happy Meal or something. Sam said he was saying things like how white men rule now that Trump has won. I was horrified. I turned around to the guy and said, I'm gay. Do you have a problem with that? And with that, he went off. Trump's won. Straight white men rule. He hit me on the head, Sam said. And because I'm a pretty big guy, I went down hard. There was blood everywhere. He kept mouthing off, but when he hit my head, things went a little blurry from that point. Described by the New South Wales police, the argument recommenced when the men's paths crossed outside the restaurant with two men allegedly assaulting two other men before they left the scene. Sam, the victim, said, don't just assume it's 2016 and everything's okay. Clearly what's happening is in the world is affecting people's judgment and mentality. I'm scared, but I also need to stand up because it's not just about me. It's about our community. The two attackers will appear in Newtown local court on December 15th. Yeah, this happened a week ago. Goddamned economic anxiety. It's everywhere. Well, hey, let's run over and check in with the angry Indian. Hey, angry.
Hey, my man, what's going on?
Oh, economic anxiety.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Is that what we're calling it now?
Yeah, well, it has to be. Because remember, this is post-racial America.
So when those Southern Democrats went crazy and were lynching black people and killing Indians arbitrarily and, you know, attacking Republicans in the roads and in the highways and in the saloons, it was economic anxiety. Yeah.
Oh, no. That wasn't economic anxiety. It's only economic anxiety if a Republican does it.
Mm. Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, we're talking about people who, I'm not trying to insult anyone, but, you know, we have a man that is, you know, Trump doesn't have goddamn real beliefs other than in his own avarice. But with Mike Pence, this is somebody who is the second most powerful person on the entire fucking planet, who believes that the planet itself is only 6,000 years old. That the earth is literally flat, except when he, you know, jumps on a flight and goes someplace or gives praise to a sniper or some kind of shit, because, you know, you have to, you know, think about the curvature of the earth, right? The azimuth, according to what I've read. So, you know, those scientific realities, be it, you know, and fuck Frank Luntz, you know, global warming, climate change, or whatever the fuck you want. You know, he doesn't believe in any of this. He believes in fairy tales. He believes in, you know, magic apples and talking snakes and crapola like that. So why would we be surprised about anything that's happening right now? Petraeus, after all of that, jail her, email Benghazi, blah, blah, blah. He wants to put Petraeus up as Secretary of State. And
yeah,
then
yeah, talking, I know.
Yeah, then he's talking about Homeland Security, Sheriff Clark over here, who's just had a rash of deaths in his prison from mistreatment.
Yeah, 4 in 1 year.
In 1 year. One of these women was pregnant, so her and the child expired. And are they counting, you know, are these Republicans counting that fetus?
No, because that's not a fetus. Online, no, because that's not a fetus that counts, Angry.
No, of course not. No, it's not European, right? You know, so it doesn't matter. It just doesn't matter. So, you know, here, you know, we're dealing with a situation. I mean, come on. His goddamn press secretary or representative, whatever the hell, that crazy chick that was, well, which one, right? Well, I'm talking about the black one, whatever her name is, because I can't remember right now. And she accused, or basically she didn't accuse. She flat out said that Obama invaded Iraq and Afghanistan. And if that had not had happened, we wouldn't be in the position that we're in now. And, you know, his ditto heads are like, you know.
Yeah.
You can have a discussion with them. And the system has let them get away with it. You just played some audio. Somebody went nuts on a goddamn flight, disrupts the flight, starts taunting people on the flight. You know, I wasn't there. More than likely, he was posturing.
More than likely, he was tanked.
Trying to pick fight. Well, whether he was tanked or not, supposedly, this is in Germany. In American law, being drunk doesn't mean any goddamn thing. This isn't fucking Berlin. Being drunk here does not take, you know, fucking, you know, they don't take that into account when they motherfucking are holding you in judgment. This is the States where they are punitive about every goddamn thing. So here we have a white man who supports Trump who fucking loses his composure on a goddamn flight. And somebody said it. Somebody said it. You read it off. Where the fuck were the sky marshals? Why was he not dealt with at the time the way a suspected Muslim would have been dealt with? Or a member.
Oh shit!
Of Black Lives Matter,
people have been
supported that.
People have been thrown off planes for speaking Arabic.
Yeah, for reading books.
And this guy doesn't get thrown off the flight or arrested for that.
Nope. No,
I mean.
So what does that tell you?
It tells me white privilege.
Well, it's white privilege, but what does that really tell you? If you have authorities that are there to prevent that type of shit, to address that type of bullshit, and they didn't fucking intervene, what does that tell you? When you have, you know, churches being burned, and yeah, they're going to look around, we're going to do an investigation, we'll bring in maybe a CIS guy to kind of look around visually and give us a breakdown, but they're not really trying to find out who's doing any goddamn thing. They're not trying. So what does this tell you? I watched doing the second Baltimore case, because the first time we talked about this, the first time the Oath Keepers showed up armed, wearing fucking Kevlar, which I thought was goddamn illegal if you were not a member of law enforcement or an active member of the special teams of the U.S. motherfucking military, because you need that bullshit when you're fucking called. Other than that, nobody's supposed to be walking around with no goddamn Kevlar, let alone these fucking field grade weapons that these fuckers are using. But they showed up the first time and took positions on rooftops. And the FBI fucking tag teams came in and told them to get the fuck out of there. That's not their goddamn job. That's not their fucking jurisdiction. They're not motherfucking law enforcement. Get the fuck out of here. This is a federal situation, right? The second time, the FBI did not go. The Justice Department just watched everything from a distance. And what did we see? Look on YouTube, look at the fucking photographs and the bloggers that have been working out there independently trying to document this shit. They're sharing gum and fucking coffee with the cops. The feds were not there the second time. The Oath Keepers are sharing bubble gum and fucking, you know, and whatever else, coffee and whatever, with the fucking cops. So what does that tell you?
Oh, I know. And, you know, meanwhile, did you happen to catch the New York Times profile of Steve Bannon?
No, but I've been hearing some flack about it. I heard it this afternoon because I was in San Francisco for a couple of days. And
oh, nice.
The things. Well, was it nice? I mean, I went again to say goodbye to somebody else who's in the last stages of fucking cancer.
Sorry.
You know, yeah. You know, thanks for that. You know, a female friend of mine, you know, another, you know, activist and shit who, you know, couldn't deal with what happened to her. Because of fucking racism, institutional racism in this fucking country, and she never got a her head together. I mean, she got to the point where she could deal with her addictions and shit. But, you know, it fucked up her liver. And now she's, you know, on her way out. And here it is. Every year I get older, right? You know, I got to fucking say goodbye to more fucking friends and shit from illness. You know, some kind of fuck, whether the disease is psychological or physical, from the racism that we put up with here. So here you have this fellow telling you that he was personally, journalistically covering a fucking event where they're, you know, Sig Heiling, they're talking about getting rid of motherfucking people, you know, they're making, you know, really broad generalizations about, you know, what we're going to do. Everybody has a final solution, but, you know, which one is better? You know, which one is more cost effective? You know, which one makes more sense? And, you know, I have also been to fucking things like this, going on 25 fucking years now, and nothing has really fucking changed. The only thing that has changed in this shit, Brother Bob, is the internet.
Well, absolutely. You know, once upon a time, they had to stand around the Ditto machines and quietly put their, you know, put their flyers up on cork boards at the grocery store and stuff, or maybe at the post office and what have you. But no, the internet that made everything out, that put everything out there, and as a consequence, that's the difference. But that's why I say what I do about, you know, alt-right, white nationalist, you know, bullshit. They're the same old white supremacist scum that they always were.
Well,
see, it's just that there's a new generation of it, regrettably.
Well, yeah. See, that's what I was getting to. See, these young fuckers are hipsters. Now, in Europe, they popped up about 15, 16 years ago, where, you know, before the term hipster came around. I mean, you know, they were just trendy motherfuckers running around, mostly France and Germany and Austria, you know, that region. And even in Alsace-Lorraine, for some fucking reason. And, you know, they're talking about, you know, this, that, and the other, you know, Hitler, yeah, he made a lot of mistakes, but, you know, his ideas were really built on Guido von Liszt. Have you ever heard of Guido von Liszt?
No.
And then, like I said, this is what I'm fucking around talking about. This is how they were having conversations. But Guido von Liszt was one of the, quote-unquote, spiritual links to what Hitler and the rest of these fuckers were doing. See, they didn't come out of a vacuum. There has always been a movement in Germany, well, the German-Austrian area, where somehow German-speaking peoples were the superior peoples of Europe. Now, the French, of course, might think that in terms of culture, but Germany took it to the idea of race, that the culture comes from the race, from the blood. That's why when they were talking about that Children of the Sun, you know, bollocks, when we spoke the last
right.
time, I knew what they were talking about. They're talking about the Children of the Black Sun. You know, the black sun is so fucking pure that it's black, right? Now, we can get into a whole motherfucking Afrocentric argument right now about melanin and all that bullshit, but I'm not going to go there. But, you know, they're making a fucking argument that Ultima Thule was the land base, was ground point, was land base zero on planet Earth for these, you know, these beings that came from the black sun. Now, where exactly that guy started, nobody really fucking
Ultima,
knows.
Ultima Thule, isn't that out of Edgar Rice Burroughs?
All of this shit is from science fiction. Vril, The Coming Race. I can't remember the name of the guy that fucking wrote it, but I just wrote about him in Efforts for
I mean, I know there's some nasty-ass racism in H.P. Lovecraft.
Oh, he was a total bigot. He hated Jews, blacks, Asians. He was afraid of everybody, and I'm not trying to, you know, insult him or anybody else like him, but he was a sickly, you know, kind of weak-willed fucking man from New England who was used to what the fuck he was used to, his small town and everything else. That's cool. Okay, fine. He was raised by women, didn't have a whole lot of contact with men. There's no evidence that he was a homosexual, and that's not even what I'm talking about. My point is that he lived a cloistered fucking life with these very narrow-minded Bible-thumping women. And even though he couldn't really get into the whole Christianity thing, he was still, you know, informed by it, like everybody else of his fucking time here from his culture. And he viewed anybody who didn't look physically, you know, Anglo-Saxon, and I mean strictly Anglo-Saxon. Russians, he was afraid of. You know, I mean, anybody who was white and spoke a foreign language, which he didn't like. If you were Caucasian and had curly hair, he wrote about you as a monster. The motherfucker was a nutcase. But he put his own, you know, personal fears and proclivities into his fucking horror. But the coming race, real. This shit was a science fiction fucking book from the, well, I think it was 1887, 1888. It was a very popular fucking book. But when it got to Germany, they took it literally. They took it literally. They had just gotten their asses kicked in World War One. Something that they were, no, they didn't start it, but they were definitely 100% behind it. Well, actually, German intelligence had supported the Serbians, in who were the Black Hand, a clandestine a group in the military that was behind the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand. And, you know, they were behind this. So they got their fucking egotistical asses kicked. So here comes this book. And then every, you know, so-called intellectual in Germany, they decided that this was the, you know, the model of what, you know, Germany could be. The idea that these blonde, totally, you know, white-skinned alabaster people living beneath the earth who come from this other motherfucking reality, the black sun type of bullshit. You know, they come up to the earth and they have this power called Vril, kind of like the Force or Chi. And goddamn, you know, if they come to the surface, that they'll take over all of mankind and kill. You know, they took this and somehow twisted this bullshit and started writing essays and books and plays and music at the time, at the turn of the century, you know, glorifying this. Hitler came up in this milieu. Hess, Rudolf Hess came up in this milieu. Himmler was a complete motherfucking occultist. His whole thing was to magically bring back the pure Germanic race to take over the entire fucking planet, starting with goddamn Europe and spreading out. They were serious about this. They would take SS soldiers and go to the fucking graves of Germans, what these ancestral Germans like, I wanted to say Bismarck, but, you know, pick a poet, you know, anybody. A musician, you know, a writer, an artist, and they would go to the graves and they would take these women that were specially chosen and they would have them try to conceive on top of the graves. This was Himmler. This was the SS. The CIA wrote about this shit. A lot of it is public. This is not a big fucking secret. None of this is secret. And when you look at the supposed alt-right, these are, you know, a lot of them from 16 to fucking 27 who know nothing of this history, who were never taught any of this in the American fucking school system. They don't know Jews any. They know nothing. They don't believe that the Holocaust happened because the literature that they read on the fuck on 4chan and 8chan says that it didn't happen. And they'll find an obscure fucking, article from a small newspaper someplace.
Oh, believe you me, I know, Angry. I had occasion. I was, for some reason or another, I wanted to know the other day what fueled the Germans' ovens. Just because I sit around thinking about how nasty coal is. And lo and behold, they were fired by coke, which is, you know, coal that's had its impurities burned off. So it burns hotter. But in order to find that out, I had to march through. I mean, I just, you know, I went over and I typed in, you know, a search engine. I just typed in what fuel was used in the ovens at Auschwitz. And boom, the search response comes back with all of this denialist horse shit before I finally scroll down and find the answer. But it's astonishing when you're confronted with what really is out there.
And there's a lot out there.
Oh, you're damn
crap
right.
Like the Lukta report. Yeah, you got crap like the Lukta report. Now, this was a nutcase who taught himself. He's literally self-taught. He taught himself how to fucking make quote unquote better execution devices. So he went throughout the Midwest and shit, selling his electric chairs and his execution equipment with no fucking real expertise. He taught himself how to fucking do this. And somehow he got involved in the Canadian neo-Nazi Zundel's case when he was prosecuted for saying that the Holocaust never took place. And if it did, well, they only killed a few thousand people, not, you know, the millions and shit that are accounted for. Now, like I said, you know, these fuckers will find an obscure fucking article that got their information wrong as proof that,
either nobody was killed, or only a few fucking, you know, a thousand people were killed. And it's fucking crazy.
It was mathematically impossible that they could kill 6 million.
That's bullshit. I mean, the more I've studied that, to fucking look at it, you know, not to prove anything, but to see what was there, yeah, they fucking did it because they were fucking Germans, if you want to get, you know, idiotic about it. And, you know, engineering and shit is what the fuck they do. Organization is what the fuck they do. And they did it to a T. It was totally fucked up, but they did it to a goddamn T. They actually had a plan. The only reason the German fucking program stands out in history is, well, there's two reasons. The victims, for all accounts and purposes, are visually white. And to be killed in the masses like that, it's not like Armenians or something. You know, to kill these fucking people like that, you know, there's, you know, for a lot, this is white power. The world is run by white power. So to look at other white people being wiped out in masses like that is shocking. That's the first fucking thing. But the second thing is what I said earlier. They were organized and they actually had a program and they documented every fucking thing because they didn't fucking think that they would ever be held accountable for it. When Hitler told his fucking generals, from what I understand, and his adjutants, this is the plan. And they're like, well, you know, people are going to fucking go crazy. And he goes, look, does anybody remember what happened to the Armenians? And he looked around the table. He said, no, nobody remembers. Nobody gave a shit. Nobody's going to give a fuck about this. Because he knew something that the fucking supposed, you know, alt-right knows. When it really comes down to every Jew in the world knows this. When it comes down to brass tacks, they don't give a fuck about Jews anywhere on the goddamn planet, including fucking Europe. And that proved it. So, you know, there was a wake-up call with a lot of shit. And like I said, you know, like I was going to say, you know, when I went to school, they did tell us in the very early 70s, and I was paying attention to this shit, that it was 4 million. By the time I got to high school, it was 6. So, you know, so what that they fucking added 2 goddamn million, frankly? You know, I mean, there was a hell of a lot more research fucking being done afterwards. And then when we really get down to numbers, 12 million fucking people were killed. Because we don't really talk about how many Africans were pulled into this, how many Asians were pulled into this. South America was the only fucking landmass really that wasn't directly involved, but they ended up harboring how many goddamn Nazis after the fucking war and who fucking sent them down there. Because I've written about that too, and we've talked about this. So when we talk about cops that are going to stand around and not fucking do anything, watching armed militias threaten fucking people of color who are demanding that the police stop killing people, black people arbitrarily. When we have somebody flipping out on the goddamn plane, when, as you said, somebody speaking Muslim or saying hello to somebody or just saying inshallah, which doesn't mean anything really other than God willing or God bless, is enough to fucking have the entire plane turn around and everybody fucking put down with their hands up for the rest of the guy. Goddamn flight. That man was allowed to fucking threaten, basically posture and threaten people and harass folks on that goddamn plane, and nothing was done. So again, what, you know, where are we here? Where are we with this? Everybody knows that something is wrong, but nobody really wants to fucking deal with what's wrong. I mean, we're looking at this fucking recount here. We're looking at these, you know, crazy ass goddamn appointments. The biggest fucking contradiction is Petraeus as goddamn Secretary of State. After all of the email nonsense that we heard about Hillary, this motherfucker was the head of the goddamn agency here that's supposed to be watching all of our fucking backs, right? That is the goddamn rhetoric. And here he is dealing with a fucking woman. I don't give a damn about his fucking affair, but he tried to be slick about it and didn't think anybody's going to monitor his ass. Imagine if another fucking world power got a hold of that bullshit and tried to blackmail that goddamn man through his mistress. And you want to talk about Hillary?
No. I mean, the hypocrisy is monumental.
From these so-called neo-Nazis who don't know a goddamn thing about Nazis, these are fucking kids who don't know a fucking thing because they were not taught this shit. Because, and I'm saying this because a lot of liberals have been part of the problem too. Let's just not talk about it. Yeah, there's a Nazi over there. Well, we'll just laugh at them and we'll just not talk about it. We'll just ignore him. We'll ignore it. And then it fucking builds up because nobody paid attention to what was happening on the fucking internet. Nobody who really was in a position to do any fucking thing did any goddamn thing. Just like the fucker who tore up Norway, Anders Breivik. And I'm sorry I'm being long-winded with this, but there's a lot of this. Anders Breivik looked for everything he did and basically put his plans out on the internet. His manifesto, he was on Google, looked for all of that crap. He was looking for the materials that he used to do those two attacks. Where were the authorities? Instead of worrying about what people are jacking off to, where were they in terms of this? The monitoring fucking, you know, anti-police brutality groups, but they're not monitoring the neo-Nazis. Why is that? And why is that not a question? Why is that not a question for Hillary? Why is that not a question for any? The only person that even came close to mentioning this shit was Bernie.
Yeah, well, but then again, I go back to that report that was issued in the earliest days of the first Obama administration. You know, the report that was commissioned by the George W. Bush administration, but, you know, Hannity had a fit over because it came out on Obama's watch, that said the single greatest threat in the United States is domestic terrorism perpetrated, you know, by right-wingers.
Well, again, no big surprise. But they're not going to, if they have the power, allow that to get out there. So, you know, they discredit it. Oh, it was bullshit. You know, I mean, you can go on Twitter and find all of these neo-Nazis there. They'll say, okay, everybody needs to get, you know, this particular hashtag out there right now. The one that I have that I'm thinking about, it says voter fraud. They knew that there was no goddamn voter fraud. I mean, there was three people arrested this goddamn election for voter fraud. Three of them were, all three of them were Trump supporters. But they put it out there. They use the internet to put it out there. Voter fraud, voter fraud. So that, you know, it keep that bullshit front. So we get caught up in, you know, in arguing and trying to defend against that. In the mean fucking time, we're being really manipulated. Like I said, a bunch of fucking kids that are freaks. They're angry with the fucking world because they're white, they're male, and they don't have any fucking power. They don't have any motherfucking money, and they're angry with the entire fucking system. And when I look at somebody like Stephen Bannon, despite the fact that he has as much money as he has, with all of these fucking white bigots, and I'm including Sherrod Clark in this, you see a bunch of insecure motherfucking men who never really fucking grew up, starting with Trump.
Oh, every, I mean, look, I mean, it's honest to God, angry. It is deeply disturbing that we really do have an incoming president who's an internet troll. Because he really is.
He really is. He says that if it's on the internet, it must be true. He said that.
I mean, he melted down over the recount this weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Last weekend, he melted down over being mocked by Saturday Night Live.
And the Europeans and the Asian governments are laughing their asses off at how stupid this system is to allow this shit to go as far as it's fucking gone. I deal with Europeans, and they're just flabbergasted. They can't fucking believe it. I mean, to them, they can't even. This one woman already told me, and she's Austrian. She said that you cannot compare Marie Le Pen, for example, or his daughter to Trump, because they said the class differences are glaring. Of course, she's totally against all of this. But she's like, look at the far right in Europe and then look at the far right in your country. She's like, you know, slobs versus what, you know. She goes, I don't even know what to call the other side because they're not honorable. But she goes, it's scary to look at what's happening here. She goes, you know, these people are fucking sloppy about every goddamn thing. They're sloppy about their information. They're sloppy about their statements. They're sloppy in their fucking dress. They can't even get their tie straight half the goddamn time. I don't know who tailors the fucking suit to these goddamn people. And they all go to the same goddamn barber. No motherfucking style whatsoever. Nothing. You know, and it's like this is supposed to be to represent the fucking number one or the only real fucking superpower on this planet. I don't have to have any fucking cash in the system, you know, to fucking still be embarrassed by this. And to be like, you know, how the fuck did he get this goddamn far? But we know how it got this far. We have a fucking population that is not very fucking educated on purpose, specifically for these reasons, right? And then we had the passing here of Dr. Fidel Castro Ruz, who outlived all of these motherfuckers.
who told us that fucking politicians like Trump will pop up in the U.S. if we didn't check the fucking system that we put in. Remember, he really never came again. He never came down like Ho Chi Minh, never really came down on the United States. He came down on the hypocrisy of the United States. We do have the vote here. We do have a hell of a lot of fucking liberties that many people here take for granted. And these same alt-right, if you want to give them that, motherfuckers, take advantage of free speech every goddamn day, and they push it to the fucking limit, and they do so with the goal of taking away your rights.
Well, that's why I asked you if you'd read that New York Times profile of Bannon.
But I already knew about Bannon.
It contains an account from a woman who used to work with him. Okay? Her name is Julia Jones. And in the New York Times article, it says, Ms. Jones, the film colleague, said that in their years working together, Mr. Bannon occasionally talked about the genetic superiority of some people and once mused about the desirability of limiting the vote to property owners. I said that would exclude a lot of African Americans, Ms. Jones recalled. He said, maybe that's not such a bad thing. I said, but what about Wendy, referring to his executive assistant? He said, she's different. She's family.
What did I tell you last time, and if you are,
I mean, my God, some of my best friends. That's I have a black friendism.
There's more to it. That yeah, he has a black friend, but it goes to show how
he's also a eugenicist. He's a eugenicist. Let's be clear about that.
And he's got a black woman who sits there and helps him promote that shit. Howard Stern has the black woman, or had, because I don't fucking listen to him, who helped him sit there and promote that shit. The whole point of putting David Clark as the head of Homeland Security is, if you got a black face up there, we just did this with Obama. If you got a black face up there and you got the police stomping on goddamn, you know, people of color and immigrants and Muslims and shit, hey, there's no racism involved. Look at the guy who's doing it. He's black.
Yeah, but this idea that he think because and we've talked about it here. Who's that awful human being who? What did he write? The bell curve.
Oh, you mean the two of them, Herrenstein and Charles Murray.
Charles Murray, there's the one. This stuff has been creeping in and trying to get academic, intellectual respectability for a while, but it may as well be phrenology. You know, the idea of genetic superiority has what should be, to anybody who knows their history, and maybe that's our problem, so few people do, it has horrifying overtones. I used the term earlier, you know, Untermenschen. Once you've identified your Untermenschen, well, you know, you can kill them. And the idea that, Steve Bannon says it's not such a bad thing to restrict voting rights to property holders?
Yeah, but what gives him the back up to say that type of bullshit? Because that's how the country started.
Well, yeah, but it's also the fact, there's clip after clip after clip, Angry, of Trump talking about how he is who he is because of his, and it's laughable even to suggest it, but he says it, because of his superior genes.
He says his superior German genes. It's on YouTube.
Yeah.
It's on YouTube. He goes, you know, the German, you know, there's something to that.
Well, here, let's see it. Let's see if I
wouldn't be where I am without that.
Let's see if I can get this clip to roll. Hang on.
Question to you. Dylan asks simply this. Do you think you were born with an innate drive for success, or do you think it was something that you've learned? And what is the most important thing, he asks, that we can teach our kids about motivation and the drive for success?
Well, I think I was born with a drive for success. I had a father who was successful. He was a builder in Brooklyn and Queens, and he was successful. And, you know, I have a certain gene. I'm a gene believer. Hey, when you connect two racehorses, you usually end up with a fast horse. And I really was, you know, I had a good gene pool from the standpoint of that. So I was pretty much driven.
Go on, Donald. Tell me I'm fired.
Becky, you do a terrible job. You're a lousy interviewer. That was the worst interview I've ever had. You are fired.
Jesus H. Christ. And, you know, by the way, that's, you know, that's from CNN. Yeah, he's got good genes.
Yeah, CNN, who just asked, are Jews people?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there was that.
Jews really?
Yeah, yeah, they fonted that, didn't they? Are Jews people? I mean, that gives me the creeps. If you're Jewish, if you're Jewish, that's got to give you the full-on horrors.
It did. The quarter is, it certainly did. Just in Palestine, she just got. I'm like, yeah. Now, what the fuck are we going to do about this? Because I'm like, if that's how he thinks about Jews, and that's how he thinks about black people, and I'm both. And you're Palestinian, and we already know he don't give a fuck about you because he doesn't think that you exist. So what the fuck are we going to do, right? And I've never, you know, she's not political, but she has had this like face of like fucking total shock for the, you know, since the election happened. Because first off, she didn't think that, you know, Hillary was going to lose. Which really, when it comes to the vote, the popular goddamn vote, she didn't motherfucking lose. But she's going to do an Al Gore and sit back and, you know, collect money from, you know, public speaking and talking about how she got screwed and all that type of shit. But, yeah, you know, a lot of people I know who are not political, who are of color, who don't want to hear a fucking thing from me. They don't want to hear the news. They don't want to hear analysis. They don't want to hear shit. Why can't you just have another glass of wine and shut the fuck up, man? Why do you bring your husband to these fucking things? This is my life, right? We don't want to talk about this. Now all of a sudden, can we talk? No. You know, it's like, where the fuck were you when all this shit was happening? You were fucking nowhere. You were nowhere. You know, you're making money. You're sending your kids to good schools and shit. And as long as you're able to do that, everything is okay. Now that you're getting heat in the street, what are we going to do? Well, it's too motherfucking late, you know? Well, it's almost too fucking late. Let's just put it that way. I mean, we're at a stage here that's close to 1933. We haven't had a Reichstag yet. And it doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to be a mirror of what the fuck happened in Germany.
No, but, you know, but you know, one more,
Paraguay.
you know, one Walmart turns into a heap of smoking rubble and some Yahoo hollers Aloha snack bar in the process. And, you know, we're off and running.
Oh, well, there was an attack today at Ohio State.
Yes.
Somali went around with a machete and started chopping up some people. We don't know what the fuck happened. You know, we have no real, you know, clue other than supposedly what they put on in some social thing I saw about he had been to Pakistan, which incidentally just announced their first transgender model. So, you know, that parent you were talking about earlier about, you know, what they should say to their kids. Well, tell them to fucking start reading international news and see what the fuck is happening around the planet. And then you'll know what the fuck to say, you know. Basically, keep an open mind and look at the facts and then make a fucking judgment. But, you know, for the most part, we got, you know, a fucking situation here that really is glaring. But if the left can't get off his fucking ass and say, okay, well, this is what we're going to do, this is what we need to do, then, you know, anything we say here is strictly academic. And we'll be talking for the next fucking 4 years. Because that's another thing that I wanted to talk to you about. A lot of people are coming down on Professor Noam Chomsky this week for saying that people that voted against, Clinton, but didn't vote for Clinton, voting for Gary Johnson or Stein, really made a fucking mistake and made a conscious mistake because they somehow thought that if they had enough goodwill that they were going to, you know, get what the fuck they wanted. And it didn't work out that way. So, you know, people are pissed, but he's asking, and he's pretty much saying the same thing I've been saying. You've had 8 years to fucking...
Well, he said that before the election, too. I mean, Chomsky was clear that he was, you know, he was clear on supporting Hillary.
Yeah, but again, yeah, and he said, I don't want to.
And, of course, the purity police called him a sellout. You know, the usual. I have no patience for that. I mean, he's you know, I'm not a huge Chomsky fan. From an some of his intellectual, you know, the stuff that he really, you know, works on, I don't necessarily buy into. I think there's a fair bit of elitism and maybe a little bit of racism in there too. But you know, look, the margin of victory in Wisconsin is lower than the number of Stein votes in Wisconsin. Now, what are you supposed to say about that?
Well, we'll find out, I guess, because she got enough money. Somehow, people reach deeper into their fucking pockets, and instead of supporting, say, for example, Progressive Radio,
they're supporting a recount.
They're supporting recount, which I'm not against. But see, here's the thing that I think is fucked up, and the late brother Castro would probably say the same thing. Why are the people having to raise money for a fucking recount?
Yeah.
Why can't we simply say, do a motherfucking recount? You know, it's just like when we had the Voting While Black incident that happened in 2000. Greg Palast was pretty fucking clear about this.
Oh, the Florida purge, you know.
Yeah, they just said, oh, yeah, it happened. Well, we won't do it again. And then they did in 2004. They did it again.
And the minute that the Voting Rights Act was struck down, they went wild.
Yep. But they're not trying to take anybody's vote. You know, they just want to make sure that only the right people vote or the white people vote.
Yeah, well, it rhymes. Yeah.
You know, I mean, Ann Coulter said it clearly. You know, if only white people voted, then the country would fix itself. Because, you know, non-whites, and I suppose she meant, you know, also the faggots and all of the other, you know, and the Muslims and all the other fucking people that she, you know, has nightmares about.
Her Untermenschen.
Oh, goddamn, they vote progressively.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, she can kiss my ass anyway. You know,
I don't even mention her on the program anymore. She's just a clown.
Well, but she's a clown that has a following. I mean, I've seen some black guys at her goddamn news things, you know, with their fucking tongues hanging out and shit. And it's like, what the fuck is wrong with you, man? You know, because I remember I got into an argument with an Asian fellow about 3 or 4 years ago. Talking about Ann Coulter's this, you know, wizard, and she's this intellectual genius and all this type of shit. And then when it came down to, after he had his fucking fifth cocktail, because he got really fucked up that night, he said, yeah, if I could get a woman like Ann Coulter, then people will understand that I really am an American. So, you know, he's going through the Dinesh D'Souza motherfucking syndrome, you know, doing his best to be accepted somewhere where he fucking isn't by throwing other people under the fucking bus. And when he gets caught, well, hey, you know, it doesn't matter, right? You know. Oh, by the way, speaking of caught, isn't Petraeus still on goddamn probation for what he got involved in?
I was wondering about that. Isn't that still, yeah.
Yeah. So how the fuck did he be anything? Well, they're talking about him. And see, and the thing is, we coddle these guys. Matter of fact, you know what, Brother Bob? This is where I was coming to. I'm tired, man. But this is where I was coming to. Why are we even entertaining, you know, arguments with people who want to bring up shit like, well, Hillary emails and fucking Benghazi, all of this bullshit. And then he comes up with Petraeus, who was proven in a court of law. It was never proven in a court of any goddamn thing that she deliberately fucking allowed the Benghazi thing to happen. It was never proved in a court of any goddamn thing that this email shit, even though it was stupid and fucking sloppy, but apparently it's been done by others, all right, that, you know, this shit did any real motherfucking damage. And then here we got, you know, Petraeus, who willingly gave away shit to somebody who was not a member of the fucking intelligence goddamn community, when we got fake motherfuckers who, like Wayne Simmons, all over Fox News, who is doing time right now for lying about being a fucking CIA goddamn career operative. We're allowing these arguments to happen. We need to just shut these motherfuckers up by telling them to shut the fuck up. You know, I mean, it's really pointless for me to get into a fucking debate with somebody for 25 goddamn minutes who knows that they're wrong. And see, and that's the other fucking shit about this, Brother Bob. They know that they're fucking full of shit. That they're wrong. That's why they need the fucking internet. Because if they can't sway you by flooding you with false information, how many times Macedonia, Russia, and what other country were they finding out was flooding the American fucking news service with fake news?
Oh, we were... And look, let's be clear, and maybe I'll get some shit for this, but it happens on our side too. There was, you know,
but that's the thing.
The one guy who was behind a whole bunch of fake news sites. I think he lives in Malibu. Gerald sent me the story, and I read it from NPR. They caught up with him, and he said, "You know, we tried to do fake news on the left, but they wouldn't fall for it." But he was responsible for, say, like that story that the Pope had endorsed Donald Trump, and it went like wildfire. Mm-hmm. But it does happen, and maybe this is probably an appropriate time to discuss this. I'm not a journalism snob, and you know, I use the term for-profit media to describe media outlets that care more about their profits than they do the quality of their so-called journalism. And for the most part, that applies to television, okay? It's not nearly as apparent in print. Because, among other things, it's hard to say that print is profiting. Print news media is still in a terrible bind. But all that having been said, I try not to get burned in what I read and what I report, but there are sites out there I do not trust because I've read them too many times, and I see, for instance, there was a story that I saw it all over Facebook yesterday. Trump threatens to what? Trump threatens to imprison Hillary over recount, and of course, it had to do with his Twitter meltdown. Mm-hmm. And there was a clip embedded in the story of Kellyanne Conway running her gob, and she makes these allusions. You know, she's very good at that. You know, well, you know, Harry Reid should watch what he says. From a legal standpoint, blah, 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 blah. But she doesn't say the thing. You know, nowhere in that story, which came from Politicus, okay, Politicus, nowhere in that story was what was contained in the headline. And I see this time and time again, especially from places like Politicus or from... what are some of the other ones? Occupy Democrats. There's one really, really big one. And time and again, there are clues. If you open up a story and the first thing is a great big ad and there's more ad than there is text, you're probably dealing with a fake news site, a clickbait site. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if there's no link inside the story to an actual produced news story, that's another clue. But it really does, and I don't like it, because it reduces us to them.
Well, okay. Well, yeah, it reduces us to them, but that's the thing on the idea where you have to fight fire with fire, and that's one aspect. But, you know, the few people that I've actually run into who told me that, you know, they had blogs and would put up information like that, and, you know, it was usually they just didn't, you know, look any further. They liked what they saw in the headline, and they've they pushed it forward. I mean, I've done that. You know, you caught me one time and pointed out that something I had posted was from a satire site, but it didn't have a whole lot of ads and all that kind of shit. So I just thought it was a blog and that this person was involved in the community and had firsthand knowledge. So I just went on that, and it turned out to be false. You found out like real quick that it was false because I didn't look any further into it. I just let it go. So, you know, if there's things that come up and, oh, well, Hillary's a fucking despicable person, you know, these folks don't really think. So they'll just literally click on it. You know, at least I can say the shit that I clicked on seemed plausible. You know, their shit is totally implausible and it's desire-based, not fact-based. So they just go ahead and push it on. But, you know, I've told you and I've written about this too. The black community does this. You know, I mean, and what's really scary is still being done with, like, information like AIDS. Like, you know, I saw a tweet, sometime last week when I was in a studio last with somebody I should have said something, but I didn't have the time. Where they're like, hey, you know, you ever notice how you only find out you have HIV after you go to the doctor? With the stay woke hashtag. And, you know, that's really fucking dangerous because you have a lot of people, again, because you have a historical distrust of the medical community for good reasons. Africans and Native Americans here have been experimented on. But that doesn't necessarily mean that every fucking, you know, thing is a conspiracy. You know, one of the biggest conspiracies has been telling black folks that somehow this is a gay disease and it doesn't affect you at all. Okay? And after people started accepting that type of information, partly because of the internet, not exclusively, but a lot to do with the internet and word of mouth. And we have HIV rates in Washington, D.C. that are higher than fucking Kenya. And that's saying something. Because of poor fucking information, people are making poor fucking choices. But again, you know, in the same vein, when we talk about the white supremacists, well, you have black supremacists too, who creeped into the black liberation movement in the fucking mid-60s, mid to late 60s, really, and really had an impact in the early 70s, where they started talking shit about melanin. So where, you know, somebody like me who's mixed, well, you know, I can be a part of the movement, but I can't be a part of anything that comes of it because I'm not really a black man. I don't have enough melanin. I'm not black enough. I don't fit the phenotype, you know, which means I don't fit the, as they put it, scientific outlook of the correct melanated black man. So because I'm mixed and shit, I can't be a part of anything and that I can't be trusted. And, you know, like when I tell you that my relations with black people, you know, are always strained, you know, it's not because really, I mean, it has a lot to do with how I dress and how I carry myself and this, that, and the other. But it's because of that fucking underlying, you know, black supremacist fucking undercurrent that has nothing to do with black liberation, but use black liberation as a cover to get his own goals ahead. And their goal is to basically do exactly what the white guys are doing, just like a fucking parrot. They talk white power, okay, black power. Even though black power really is about black people having control over their communities. But, you know, Stokely Carmichael and what have you. But, you know, Kwame Ture, right? But, you know, when you start getting into, you know, not being very educated and not looking at the grays and simply wanting to meet, you know, fire with fire. Okay, so black power now becomes a black supremacy thing. And then, you know, when you really look at it, and I got, you know, fucking tons of shit on my blogs about this, you will find that the Nation of Islam supported Trump. And they've supported a number of white supremacists over the fucking decades. They were part of the goddamn People's Temple in San Francisco. Did you know that?
I did not.
Okay.
But you know, that support is because it's a mirror image of itself.
It's a bit like, look, if the Nation of Islam ever said, you know what, we have our ideology, which I don't necessarily go against. I believe every fucking African on the planet should read Message to the Black Man. I really do. It didn't like the Bible is not to be taken literally, but it is a fucking insight into where black people were in America at that particular fucking time. You know, and the world, really, at that particular time. But how do you go if you're really a fucking black nationalist? How do you go from from Message to the Black Man, and I'm saying this on a white radio program. How do you go from Message to the Black Man to Scientology, which was founded by L. Ron Hubbard, who not only, you know, was...
Oh, my God. And you know, another 3 hours and we would still be on this, no doubt about it. One other thing, though, that kind of, you know, sort of gave me a dose of the, hey, look, fascism. This list that was promulgated over the weekend by the Washington Post of Russian-influenced puppet websites. Mm-hmm. Did you catch that?
No, I tell you, I was busy. But
oh, that's right. That's right. You were traveling.
Tell me about it.
Well,
because they're out there.
Well, they're out there, but they're not who they say that. They're not who the Washington Post says it is.
What did they say?
Truth out.
They said that those sites belong to Truth Out?
No, they're saying that Truth Out is a Russian puppet site. What's the other Alexander Coburn who died a few years back?
Counterpunch,
Truth Dig.
Counterpunch.org. Well, I can see them saying that, but you know, even then, that'd be bullshit if you really read what the fuck they. I've been having issues with Counterpunch.
Well, I don't agree with everything I read there.
You can't if you think you shouldn't.
But it's. It's you know, when you're, I mean, really, Truth Out? I've been reading them for years, and, you know, it's just, they're actually doing journalism. They actually do reporting.
And that's why they're accusing them. Because, see, if they wanted to really talk about, you know, links to Russia, they would have to look at Red State. They would have to look at Breitbart. Well, they had to look at Breitbart first. They would have to look at Fox. But you got to remember, nobody said anything at Fox when, because this has changed, you know, fairly recently. But, I mean, what, 48% of the stock at one point was owned by a Saudi Arabian sheikh, a member of the royal family, or connected to the royal family. Had half of, well, almost half of the, because, you know, you didn't think Murdoch was going to give up the controlling stock.
Right.
But the sheikh had 48% of it. At the same time that they were reporting anti-Arab, anti-Muslim, you know, material, right? So what's really happening? I mean, there were claims made about The Intercept because Pierre Olmevar, I can't remember his last name, the person funding Glenn Greenwald behind that supposedly had some sketchy connections.
Well, okay, so, I mean, anybody wanting to go read it, at the Washington Post, under their business section, Russian propaganda effort helped spread fake news during election, experts say. But then they cite an anonymous group who declare who is and is not a Russian puppet.
We're not supposed to take their word for it.
That's right, yeah.
Was really working for Trump.
It comes
not
from
the news agencies.
Prop or not, a nonpartisan collection of researchers with foreign policy, military, and technology backgrounds plan to release its own findings on the startling reach and effectiveness of Russian propaganda campaigns. Okay? Prop or Not's monitoring report, which was provided to the Washington Post in advance of its public release, identifies more than 200 websites as routine peddlers of Russian propaganda during the election season, with combined audiences of at least 15 million Americans. And
Truth Out is on that list.
Yeah.
Is Democracy Now on that list too?
Let's see. I am not sure. I'm looking. Glenn Greenwald had a purple polka dotted blue screen and hissy over it.
Oh, he's on the list, huh?
let's see.
And see, with him, it would be a little bit more of a legitimate, you know, charge. I mean, he's if he hasn't been to Russia, I mean, where did he and Laura Petraeus interview Snowden?
Yeah.
I mean, the the Russians had to give him, you know, some sort of leeway in order to do that. The same way the Mexican government gave Sean Penn a little leeway to fucking interview El Chapo. There's no way that they didn't fucking know that that shit was happening. You know, so that's, you know, I mean, if you're going to say anything about anybody, it would make more sense to say something like that about Greenwald. But Greenwald is hooked up with The Intercept, too, which I said there were people who were raising questions about that when they first launched, when they first got up off the ground.
And that's, it, yeah. Glenn Greenwald and Ben Norton have the story over at The Intercept. Washington Post disgracefully promotes a McCarthyite blacklist from a new, hidden, and very shady group. Mm-hmm. Because the Post, you know, the Post relies on it, but they're more than happy to show that they're you know, anonymous and won't divulge who it is that's making this list. And it is disturbing.
Although it's a fucking disturbance of Orwellian. And, you know, Aurelian proportions.
Mm-hmm.
If we can't fucking trust anything that we're goddamn reading, which, you know, I mean, I remember, Raw Story, I'll try to say this quick. Rawstory.com has where I've accidentally hit some links following Twitter. Because that's the only social media I fuck with is on Twitter. And in the sidebar where they're trying, where they have their ad revenue spaces. There were links to Newsmax, and there were links to Breitbart. And I remember, at least I pretty much remember doing this, a couple of times I challenged them through their Twitter account on Twitter as to why they would carry ads like that. Even though I understand you need the revenue, why would you carry Newsmax and fucking Breitbart? They never got back to me. You know, they never said anything. I mean, usually if I've said something about, you know, PBS or whatever the fuck, they respond. They never said anything. So, you know, Raw Story.
Oh, okay. So, Truth Out, Naked Capitalism, Black Agenda Report, Consortium News, Truth Dig, and over on the right wing, Zero Hedge, Antiwar.com, and the Ron Paul Institute.
Well, Zero Hedge will fucking, because I used to use them as a source, for the simple fact, and I mean this, for the simple fucking fact, that they pretty much copy and paste every weird piece of news that they come into contact with. UFOs, Bigfoot, anything. So, you know, if you want to look for obscure bullshit that has no provenance, Zero Hedge is the way to go. I mean, they're like Alex Jones without any fucking restrictions. You know, really. And I suppose they call themselves, the cat named, or calls himself Tyler Durden, because there was a scandal about that too.
But now, this is McCarthy-esque red baiting. Only, you know, Russia's not red anymore.
Well, see, that's the whole thing. There's no real big bad enemy. I mean, they tried to do it with Islam, and they've done that. But when you get this fucking paranoid, everybody looks scary to you. And then, like I said, you know, Zero Hedge, I think they're stupid. You know, and like I said, you know, this Tyler Durden cat, turns out that there is no Tyler Durden. That Tyler Durden is about three different people. If you go look that up and follow that up. So if that's connected to Russia from a situation like that, I could see. Because it turns out that, you know, what they're putting out there is knowingly disinformation. And then, like I said, I thought it was one person, and it turns out to be three different people that pulls is at the guy from Zero Hedge. But with Glenn Greenwald, we know who the fuck he is. And the only real thing that I said would make any sense to look at him is because he's been given access to somebody who is a fucking intelligence goddamn person who absconded and went to motherfucking Russia. And the Russians gave him access. So, you know, I mean, if they wanted to do that, you know, that makes more sense. But to have a list like this, I mean, Black Agenda Report, is a radical black socialist news service.
Yeah, I know. I read it.
Pro-Russia? Yeah, I mean, pro-Russia, you know, probably in terms of getting their argument across. But they would cite the fascism and shit going on in Russia fucking just as fast as any other, you know, left-wing news agency. That's worth any goddamn thing. I mean, what you said was important, Brother Bob. It's hard to do propaganda on the left because the left wants proof, usually.
Yeah, it is.
80% of us. I know when I get into an argument, I have to have reams of goddamn information.
And I just, you know, for my part, when I it's just how I learn to read this stuff. I'm not saying I can't be fooled and I can't get stuff wrong. I can and I do. But I've got a pretty finely tuned bullshit filter. And it lights up quite often.
Because you really give a damn about the truth instead of just what you want. That's the difference between us and them. And it literally is the difference.
Well, if an argument proceeds from something that is false, the argument by definition becomes false as well, and you're screwed at that point. Hey, Angry, I got to get out of here, brother. I appreciate it, but it's been a great conversation.
All right, everybody. You do what you can. Keep this fucking thing on the air, because if you don't have programs like The Horn, what the fuck are you going to do with the type of bullshit that we're talking about? The news out here ain't real. So do what you can to support this show. Peace.
Thank you, Angry. Thank you very kindly. And thank you to Glenn. Thank you, Glenn, very much. We took a fundraising goal down to $465 to finish November. It really would be great if we could finish November ahead, beat the Swede, and get started on December. And I got to get out of here right now. We'll talk a little bit more maybe tomorrow. My ongoing, well, I don't, I go back and forth on whether or not I ought to take the program out to North Dakota, because it's a difficult call. But anyway, have a great evening. Got to get out of here. Thanks, everybody. Always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.